I'm very lucky tonight to have three, not one, not two, not three, but four guests coming to join me. They're all due to be present at next week's Conscious Tribal Gathering up in North Wales. So I've got Steve Jones, who talks about creating cooperative communities and about permaculture. We've got Steph Jackson and Andrea Prophet, who are going to be talking to us a little bit about ethical beekeeping. And I've also got Ollie Boone, who's going to be talking a little bit about indigenous healing techniques, also from the Peruvian Amazon. So a very big welcome to all of you. Thanks very much for joining me on the show.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rock.
Excited to be here.
Excited to be here.
Well, it's great because, of course, I met most of you. I met Andrea at this year's Fire in the Mountain, and Ollie and Steve and Steph I met up at the permaculture course at Beryl's Place recently. So we've met face to face, which is really great. That was a real hive of activity you were all involved in there. How did the permaculture designs go for that weekend?
The final presentations actually on that course were off the scale. We had some really, really good ones. I mean, notably, I mean, we could talk about it later, but we did have some fantastic presentations and some great characters. It was a fantastic course. Really enjoyable.
I think a lot of people left the course having their minds thoroughly expanded starting to view the world from a much different perspective, you know?
Yeah, I can personally attest to that. It definitely changed my kind of world view and how I view ecological systems and our position within them. And certainly we've got some tools and techniques and what to work with there on many different levels for the future. So, yeah, it was really, really beneficial on many different aspects of my life, for sure.
Yeah, I've got to say, having come in and seen the presentations at the end of the course and having done the course actually back in 2008, it was really fascinating to see this full circle process, you know, and to still see, you know, so many people getting so much from these courses, you know, and seeing how my life is now being integrated into this process, you know, having done that course and been working with these principles for, you know, a number of years now. And, you know, as you'll find out during the course of this evening, where these interwoven parts of it are. I'll leave it at that for now.
Oh, that'd be really good, yes, because hopefully we'll be talking about solutions to do with permaculture on a more or less national scale as well as the smaller scales, because it is a scalable idea, isn't it? You can use it to help design or promote culture as well as horticulture. It's not just limited to gardening.
Oh no, it's almost got nothing to do with gardening really, but gardening's the first and most obvious application of permaculture design. But no, it's about culture, it's about people, it's about our relationship with the planet. That's what's gone wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. Nature knows what it's doing, it's how we relate to it that's the problem, yeah.
I think I was talking last week with a man called Pat Veldon about the Brehon laws, which used to be applicable and to a certain extent still are in Ireland and Scotland. And he was pointing out, as I've been reading, that the laws in those days were designed to protect the people and the environment. That, you know, it was you couldn't really look after the people unless you were looking after the thing that looks after them.
Well, that's the very heart of our problem, or the mistake that we've made, is that we've separated ourselves from the environment or seen ourselves as being separate from it. Of course, we're just part of it. But somehow with our kind of reductive thinking or whatever, we've managed to somehow see it as something that's outside of ourselves. And that's the root of the problem.
I had a very interesting conversation recently with a man I know who is a Catholic. And I suggested to him that we were here to make soil. And he thought that was an appalling idea. He thought we were here to concentrate on our spiritual welfare. And I said, basically, look, we've spent eons being spirit. This is the cutting edge of reality, the 3D and the soil and all the plants and all of that. And we're here to be gardeners and to, you know, to foster and care for.
to be guardians and stewards of the earth, you know.
Yeah.
It's a responsibility that I think's been a lot of us have forgotten that it's a role.
But it's coming back.
To recognise that on a very fundamental level, we are soil. We are soil. We are made out of exactly the same minerals and elements, and our gut, the flora and fauna in our gut that enables us to digest our food and access those nutrients that make us allow us to live are the very same ones that are in the soil. Mm-hmm. We are soil, and that the idea of us separating ourselves from it is, that's the absurdity, and that's the the connection that has to be repaired.
Yeah, and in many ways, and on social levels as well, you know, as with the Earth, because it is all intrinsically the same thing, you know, and it's really coming back to that relationship, isn't it, you know, with whatever it is that's around you, you know, and that stands, and that's where the permaculture principles for me anyway have come into it, you know, because it relates to so many different aspects of our human being, you know, and it's just a really great structure for people, I think, to understand how to interact, you know, and how to really sort of have a tool belt full of things that you can actually practically put into place, you know, wherever you are, whether you're in a city or whether you're in, you know, a rural situation, wherever in the world you are, you know, it's about looking at that land and really observing and interacting, isn't it? You know, the first and foremost.
Yeah, and I mean, every single piece of land is different in terms of what will grow on it, how fast it will grow, what will become dominant, what creatures there are there. So it's got to be observed before you can start working with it, really.
Yeah. Exactly, and that stands for ourselves as well, doesn't it? You know,
every different person on the planet's different as well, and those same principles and ethics can be applied to our lives.
Yeah,
permaculture celebrates diversity, doesn't it? So then we see diversity in every form, you know, in every human relationships and
practical solutions, isn't it? It's offering those practical solutions, you know, which is a real key part of it for me.
And I think those permaculture principles that you mentioned are a fantastic kind of list of guidelines. And you're saying it was you, wasn't it, Steve? I'll get used to your voices soon.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were saying.
This just sounds really popular.
Yeah. No. Let's do that. So Steve,
we jumped in there really quickly. So maybe we should backpedal a little bit and say hello, people. It's really great to be here, and wonderful to be talking to you on your show.
Yeah.
And we are Ollie sitting here on my right. Ollie.
Hello, my name's Ollie. I'm going to be doing a talk next weekend at the Conscious Tribal Gathering in Glyndefwy, near Llangollen, with two other people that's here today. They're also going to be doing talks. My area of specialty, I might say, is Indigenous healing techniques. So I've been with my partner Steph here. We spent the last 5 years traveling Central and South America. For the last 2 years, quite intensely, I've been studying Indigenous healing. It's an area of study called curanderismo, which means the art of healing. So I've spent multiple times in the Amazon and the Andes studying of Indigenous healers. I'm going to be talking a lot about the psychosomatic connection that we have with our mind and our body. I'm going to be talking a little bit about, at the beginning of my talk, on consciousness, on Gnosticism and the concept of animism or panpsychism. I'll be going into more detail of that in the talk. We can skim over this a little bit on the interview, which I'll be happy to talk through. There's a lot of these techniques and a lot of these philosophies and how kind of suppressed emotions, suppressed traumas can associate with different parts of our body, different organs. And I'll be hopefully shedding a little bit of light on the Indigenous kind of philosophy around that. So that's my other specialty. I've also took part, as I just mentioned, in Steve's permaculture course. And I also took part in the apprentice program with Jerry Freeman, who the girls will be talking about later, the beekeeper, the ethical beekeeper in Peru. That's me. I'm looking forward to doing the show. Thank you very much for asking me on, Dr. Rock.
No problem. Sounds like spending there for a whole show in itself. Look forward to hearing what you're saying there, because it's a subject of great interest to me, consciousness and connection with plants and the art of healing people by going to the root of the problem rather than by trying to mask the symptoms. So we'll get back to that shortly. But I guess, being, as you mentioned, the ethical beekeeping side of things, we might as well hear from Steph and Andrea. Steph, how do you end up doing ethical beekeeping?
Ollie just mentioned that we were travelling around South America for some years, and eventually we made our way to Peru, where we met Jerry Freeman. I was actually working at a seed preservation farm there in the valley, and I noticed that there was a top bar beehive there. So it wasn't a traditional hive that you see a lot in the States or in the UK. It was like an African top bar. basically shaped like an upside down Toblerone, and it mimics a hollow log. And I was fascinated by the structure and how well the bees flourished within that hive. And then one day, Jerry, they called him the bee shaman, actually, because of the way that he worked with his bees with a deep level of reverence and respect for the honeybees. And he had a really spiritual connection with them, actually. So I was really excited to meet him. And he came one day and I ran straight up to him. And I was like, Jerry, I want to learn about bees. And he was like, oh, what do you know about bees? I was like, nothing, you know. So he decided to put together an apprenticeship scheme. And so there was myself involved in that, Andrea and Ollie. And that was basically the first portal, the first doorway to the mysterious world of the bee. And I guess since then, I've never looked back. And I'm really grateful to have been introduced in that manner, in terms of working with bees from a bee-centric position rather than, you know, just working with them to suit our own needs, like a humanistic, from a humanistic system. And I guess my experience has just developed from there, really, moving beyond an apprentice to basically becoming a bee guardian rather than a beekeeper. Because it's like Steve said earlier, Mother Nature and the bees included, they know how to live. And there's a lot that we can learn from the bees too, as long as we can observe how they like to live, and we can mimic that system in a way that suits their needs, but also benefits our needs too.
Well, they're certainly a well cooperative and intelligent species, aren't they?
Yeah, they're super intelligent, actually. And just having been in the position of spending time with them as well, it's a very privileged one, actually. When you realise all that they do for us in terms of pollination and basically maintaining our lives on this earth, you know, it's something that has to be entered into with a deep level of respect. Rather than just using them for honey and pollination services, we can learn so much more than that. Simply in terms of how the bees work to benefit their own, you know, their own needs. They're essentially maintaining life for all of us. And if we could take even that small lesson, benefiting the wider world as well as our immediate communities, I think we'd be well on our way to a more cohesive structure.
Definitely. I'll say aho to that, most for sure.
Uh-huh. You know, I think meeting Jerry and being involved with that apprenticeship and starting to understand really the symbiotic relationship, you know, that we have with, we're all creatures, you know, in many ways. And then, you know, looking into this bee world and finding so many people, you know, on this same page with it and starting to understand, you know, how important these relationships are that we've got and that we, you know, cherish them and nurture them, you know, exactly. As Steph is saying. And, you know, hats off to Steph, you know, she's come back and, you know, created Irony Beekeeping and just an amazing internal relationship, you know, that has happened and that I'm seeing happen, you know, within Steph, mm-hmm. you know, through working with the bees and having just caught a swarm, you know, you know, starting to look after us this amazing, you know, entity that's come into Steph's life and all our lives, and I guess in intrinsically, you know.
Yeah,
it's just incredible, you know, and I'm looking forward to being static and starting that relationship myself. And I think that's that empowerment is that wanting to share that information now, you know.
Mm-hmm. And are you finding it to be as much a sort of shamanic and spiritual experience? You're presumably learning from the bees, are you?
Definitely. The bees are really my teacher. I mean, Jerry, he essentially opened the door for us to the world of the bee. But, you know, sadly, he passed away last year. And so there was a point that we all had to step beyond that position of student and then really step into that position of bee guardian and then learn from the bees themselves, because there were so many more questions I had. But I find that you can really open a channel of communication between yourself and the bee when you start to surrender fear of being stung and gradually remove pieces of your uniform. I think that's really important, actually, because, you know, typically beekeepers, they don this huge, you know, uniform that creates this really thick layer between them and the bees. And so I find beekeepers that wear too much uniform, they can be a little bit hasty with the bees and kind of maybe enforce themselves a bit too heavily on the bees, kind of doing what they want to do rather than watching and observing the bees and how they're interacting with one another. and what they're trying to communicate to you. So
I think you're dealing with African bees, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not African bees. But one thing
maybe you do need a bit of suit.
Yes, probably.
It's important. It's important. Yeah, it's important to start understanding this. Like the separation isn't actually there.
Well, it's
which really is leading back to Ollie's stuff in the consciousness stuff. You know, it's like.
It's a gradual thing, though, as well.
Yeah.
I find when there's not a protective layer, you are a lot more open to, like, the sound of the bees, the buzz. You know, the buzz is the vibration. Mm. And you can tell how they're feeling based on how the buzz sounds. So if the buzz kind of picks up, so it's like bzzz, then you know that something's stressing them out, and then you adapt your behavior accordingly. And it's a really nice feeling, actually, to have bees crawling all over your hands and on your face, and just not to feel fear whatsoever, you know. Mm. Actually, the bees emanate a really beautiful vibration of love and kindness. And I think if you approach them with that similar vibration within your heart, just wishing them goodwill, they respond accordingly.
And I can attest to that. You know, watching how Steph works with the hive, you know, it's you know, it's very, very rare that I see her being stung.
Do get stung sometimes.
Very rarely. I get stung quite a bit. Sometimes in some funny places.
It's always better to operate from a position of mutual trust, if that's possible, isn't
it? Exactly. Every time before she enters the hive, you know, before she sits down, and she finds a space of peace in her heart, and she communicates with them. You know, she talks the bees through everything that they're going to do, and you know, it's really amazing to see how calm they are, you know, as opposed to someone just jumping in there with the full suit on going, I'm going to do this, I'm doing that.
Smoke in there.
And
it's all to do with the underlying ethos of bee-centric, bee guardianship. You know, it's not coming from me. Essentially, you need to ask permission, you know, firstly enter into their space gradually. And it's a meditation. It's a meditative process. And so you have to bring yourself into blissful awareness of love and joy, you know, to be able to enter that space. And before I open, I always, as Ollie said, I place my hands on the hive and just explain what I'm about to do, and then to ask permission to allow me in.
It's a very similar process to how we work with the plants. But anyway, so let's finish the introductions.
Hello, very nice to be here. Thanks for having us. I mean, obviously, I was in Peru, as we've discussed with Steph and Ollie, and I did the beekeeping apprenticeship, and myself and Steph are going to be, I'm going to be helping Steph, actually. Main thing that I'm going to be doing, which we missed off at the start, is Craftanoons, which is something that has sprung from a desire to allow people to create, really, and come back to their innate creativity through using recycled and upcycled craft skills. So we've been a part of the Conscious Camps for a little while, for the last couple. And we're going to be teaching people some amazing skills regarding that. There's another area, I guess, that I've been involved with the permaculture, and it's something that, as I said before, has been an underlying element of my life over the last seven years. Which has sparked off a major interest in education, I guess, you know, in a lot of ways, which stems back to the Craftanoons and starts kind of feeding into this sort of web, really, of, I suppose, movement and change, really, that I want to create in the form of forest schools and food forests and different projects that I'm working on. I mean, I guess the main element, really, from where I'm coming from is putting people together, you know, and creating events and creating gatherings which enable people to learn skills, tools, you know, whatever it is that they need to get from that experience to be able to move their life forward in a positive way. So, you know, what I'm trying to do at the moment is pull all of these things together, which seems to be happening, which is going to link into, I think, where Steve's going to come into this now and explain, you know, this closed loop system that seems to have happened over the years. So intrinsically, I'm running a page called The Food Forest, which is eventually going to turn into a real food forest. That's on Facebook. I'm running Craftanoons with a dear friend, Victoria Ashley, who is a creative genius in many ways. And we're going to be at Conscious Tribal Gathering next week. And also I have the Soul Tribe Gathering, which is going to be a collaboration between many people that will happen next year in 2016, which will be a transformational gathering. And I think, you know, over the last few years, I've been moving around the globe a little bit too and come across some really interesting groups of people who are putting together some great transformational gatherings, you know, that are bringing some quite serious forces together.
That sounds brilliant. I'm really a great supporter of festivals and gatherings, especially small ones, as people who listen to the show regularly know, because I broadcast from them. And I, certainly for me, they're an absolutely essential part of the year, getting out into the open amongst like-minded spirits and kind of talking and entertaining each other and learning new stuff is where it's at, as far as I'm concerned. It's what life should be about for all of us most of the time.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Empowerment and growth and movement and change and all of that lovely stuff.
Brilliant. Well, we'll get back to the ethical beekeeping a little bit later on as well. Thank you. Thanks both, Steph and Andrea. And Steve, you've been, for a long time now, you've been involved in actually helping to set up housing cooperatives and so enable people to live in an atmosphere where they're sharing skills and stuff. Where did you start doing that?
Well, we were just about to celebrate the 20th birthday of Chicken Shack Housing Cooperative, which is fantastically large. For me, anyway, it feels like a major milestone. That was our first sort of manifestation of the dream, really. It started, I was just thinking about some parallels you were telling us, your bee story, Steph. For me, it started on a different mountainside, on a different continent, but I stumbled across a small holding in eastern highlands of Zimbabwe in 1990 or 91, and I met a guy called Graham Metlerkamp, who had a little 8-acre small holding, and to this day, it's the most productive piece of land I've ever seen in my life. And I walked onto it, and walked on it to buy a piece of cheese. And it had a little sign on the gate saying cheese. And I walked in, and I fell in love with the place. I fell in love with him. I fell in love with the lifestyle, everything to do with it.
There was a whole series of synchronicities.
Right, no, I can't tell the whole story.
That's for another show.
Led me to that place on that particular day. And then, sadly, shortly after, Graham passed away, and I was sort of left with this legacy of kind of, you know, his spirit, his energy, and what he created on this farm. And we actually started a traveler's lodge on the next door farm, which was also being derelict. It's called Heaven Lodge. Look at it, it's up on, got a great page on Facebook. But we set it up using permaculture principles, and I bought two of Graham's cows, and he taught me to make cheese, and I made cheese. And that was how I got involved in permaculture. It's Zimbabwe. They're serious about growing food and stuff like that, you know. So,
I mean, is it still running, that particular venture?
It actually is, yes, it is.
You see, that's one of the things I like about what you're doing, is there does appear to be a good foundation to it. They're not things that sort of arise and then fall apart. There must have been pretty serious challenges, I would have thought, in Chicken Shack and in the Zimbabwean place through which they've learnt. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and it's been a massive journey. And this really leads on to it, really, is the process of conceiving, finding out how to do it, the funding, the this, that, never, and setting up a co-op from scratch. It taught us so much, but really the lesson began once we were there and started with 8 of us there initially, and trying to work out, you know, in a place that actually wasn't, it's cold and drafty and all, you know, run-down farmhouse and in the middle of nowhere kind of thing. So it was a serious challenge. And we learned so much by doing that. And right from the beginning, we were involved in hosting and permaculture courses and sharing knowledge and building community. Because I instantly recognized what I learned from Africa was one thing right from the outset was you just can't do it by yourself. You have to work out how to collaborate with other people. And Africans, they do that naturally. They're people-orientated people. I'm sure you found the same in the Andes and stuff like that. They're rich in human connections.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Very much of community values in place, isn't there? You know, it's like very centered around that.
So since I've been involved in permaculture work in the UK, it's always been to me about cooperatives and finding ways that people can work together and gain control of assets so that we can manage them sensibly and, you know, according to permaculture principles and environmental responsibility and create spaces where people can come together and learn and share skills and all the things that you guys are talking about.
Do you find that the permaculture courses actually help kind of cement and build the community that you are working on?
More than we realise as well, you know, because it's we like to move the courses around. I think we've just done number 29, I think, our 29th BDC. So over the years, we've done quite a few different venues, like 3-4 times maybe at a place, and then we might move on or come back a few years later. But, yeah, no, it sends a jolt of energy through the place. We get a load of work done, we build a compost toilet, turn the compost heaps, prune the fruit trees, you know, draw some nice mats and take some measurements and, you know, do some survey.
Leave a trace, doesn't it?
It's, yes.
You know, this whole leave no trace.
Yeah. Like, no, leave a positive.
Flipped it on its head and...
Leave some compost and...
I just had the privilege of the last about 2 weeks ago, I was touring with an indigenous elder from Ecuador, and that was exactly what their ethos is from the Sequoia tribe. And they said, like, when we go to a place, we always try and leave it better than that we found
it. Absolutely, yeah.
There's a lot of people like leave no trace, but I think it's an important thing to leave a positive impact in every place that you visit, whether that's like physically or, you know, or through people, you know.
Relationships. But at least some compost. Yeah, that's a place richer and better and more fertile than when you arrive.
I'm really pleased to hear that, because that's been mine and Jess or Synchro's approach really for years now, is that we try to leave places improved for our passing. And actually, compost heaps is something I leave a lot of scattered around the place. I really like making compost heaps.
Potential, new potential, isn't it?
It is, and you can make so much of it as well. And I guess that's one of the things I think about these kind of projects is that you do need many hands and many boots and many minds on things. That basically self-sufficiency involves a recognition of interdependence, and so cooperation of need really arises. And you can't beat working with people to get to know them either.
It's the only way to really get to know people is by doing things together. And I think it's something else which we try to teach and engender through the permaculture courses. The only way that we can build community as well is by having collective assets, by having things that we all take responsibility for, you know, both enjoy taking responsibility for managing them, but also enjoying them. So, I love developing community orchards and food forests in public spaces, and then leaving that as a tool for community people to get to know each other, and, you know, the fruits belongs to whoever picks it, you know, and
what they do with it, whether it's a jam, whether it's a pie, whether
it all ends up getting shared anyway, doesn't it? You know,
yeah. However it comes, it's that, you know, it's building more resilience, isn't it, into community.
So the co-ops thing, and I'll just to tie together my little sort of intro pieces. I've just written a piece which I've just put on the website, which is Dragons Housing Co-op. Was that Dragons Housing Co-op? I'm co-op.co.uk. Which is to celebrate 20 years of Chicken Shack. Well, not specifically, but it's an interesting synchronicity is on exactly the same, exactly 20 years to the day since we set up and moved into Chicken Shack. We're launching our new housing co-op, which is based in Llanrider. It's called Dragons Housing Co-op. And it involves a shop and an office. So we're going to physically have a space to base teaching, permaculture teaching practice, which is Sector 39. So it's kind of a headquarters for the design course, and a shop window on all of the stuff that Ollie and Steph and Andrea and many other people that we're associated with do. So it's a very exciting moment for us. So, we'd like to just
announce.
And Andrea is one of the co-founders, and she's also going to be living there in the housing co-op part. So, that's our news. And obviously, you're a little bit aware of that yourself, Dr. Rock, because we chatted about it when you came up to visit us on the the PDC at Beryl's a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, so. we're both of us very, very much looking forward to coming along and seeing what's going on there. And we love Pistiff Rioter. What a beautiful neck of the woods to be setting yourself up in.
Oh, no, it's actually on. We're on the literally the first house on the other end of the road that goes to the waterfall. So.
Right.
Great location.
A lot of traffic that goes through there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you won't have any problem making the place look attractive.
Yeah. so we get the keys a week tomorrow.
Oh, brilliant.
Very exciting.
Brilliant. Well, we'll have to make sure we come over and give it the once-over and stuff. What was the name of the web?
We're going to be having some little events,
aren't
we?
Yes.
What was the name of...
to be involved in your broadcast, and that's also something which I think we're very interested in building there. As well, is a hub to disseminate and share, you know, information and share the experience of the community transition and, you know, and et cetera, that we're all involved in. And
I can see some collaborations, maybe Dr. Rock can come and guest on some of your podcasts.
And People's Internet Radio is always looking for new hosts. We have slots available. So, fantastic. Sign us up, please.
We're more than keen.
We're in.
We've got a lot to talk about. We've got a lot of access to a lot of music as well. We're surrounded by musicians and both techno musicians and folky musicians. So we'd love to share some of that with you.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, it sounds like you got it all sorted. All we need to do is press the go-tit at some point.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that impresses me about all of you is that you're out there learning and seeking solutions to really some quite challenging problems, the problems of community and how to keep our bees well, which is currently recognised as a really serious challenge.
We'd love our shop to be a hub to have that dialogue. And I think every community needs to have that, though, is the bee conversation to support beekeeping in the area.
Yeah, definitely. I would really like to actually work with you guys at Dragon's Cup to perhaps set up a demonstration hive for honeybees. Because as Andrea mentioned earlier, I came back to the UK this year and captured my first swarm and established Aini beekeeping. Aini beekeeping, the word Aini, it's an old Quechua term. It basically means it's reciprocity or the interchange of love and kindness. In the Andes, they hold this, it's a cosmic law to them, Aini, and they understand that nothing goes one way. It's a constant interchange of love and labor and respect, which is something that we've lost touch with a little bit over here in the West. And I think that's partly the problem as to why bees are declining. You know, we've been utilizing the resources of bees, using them for pollination services, exploiting their labor and taking their honey, without really giving anything back to them. And so, establishing Aini beekeeping really is a way of kind of showing how we can work with them in unity, giving them all that they need so that they can live in a coherent structure, in a natural structure, and basically teaching people that they can work alongside those guidelines and actually keep bees for themselves, adhering to that ethos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's about more than that too. It's really creating balanced habitats for bees. So a world that benefits bees benefits us too,
It's not necessarily just the honeybees, like we're talking about the wild bees as well. You've got like 250 plus, you know, types of wild bees, and to create habitats for wild bees is
just as important, really quite important.
It's super important, yeah.
You know, and there's information I know on Aini beekeeping, you know, about that. So if anyone wants to check, check that.
I really love the wild bees. I mean, one of the places we spend a lot of our time has got a lot of old stone buildings with soft lime mortar, and they seem to really like living in holes. And I was looking on the wild raspberries the other day and saw, I think I counted 7 different sorts of what I would classify as a bumblebee. You know, the round-bodied one with colourful fur.
Yes.
Yeah, there's so many different types of bees. I've been blown away, actually, this springtime. Because, obviously, arriving to the UK, I didn't have my honeybees until I caught the swarm. So I had the opportunity to really get to know wild bees and bumblebees and appreciate them for the services they do and just the beautiful ways in which they live. Yeah,
I mean, springtime coming with amazing. Yeah. Having not been here.
Seeing all the queen bees flying around before they've built their nests and things. And, you know, it's really important to take care of those wild bees, because when a lot of people think of bees, they do think of honeybees, you know, because they are so productive and really, really good at pollination. But but they, you know, they only fulfil a percentage.
A small percentage
on the grand scheme, you know.
And do they behave differently from bumblebees? What's the... What?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Most bees aren't even social animals.
Yeah, most of them are solitary, yeah. Yes. I mean, bumblebees, they live in hives, but much, much smaller hives. And so they do have that method of communication amongst the hive. Mm. With the queen bee, like a similar structure with the queen bee... And then all of the forager bees and then some drones. But the honeybees, the reason why they're so productive is simply because it's a huge, huge hive. And the solitary bees, they don't really communicate in the same kind of way. They just live in a small holding for themselves. But they fulfill a huge percentage of our pollination services. And different bees pollinate different plants as well. And so if we don't have abundance and variety and diversity in bee species, then we wouldn't have diversity in food that we have.
Of course, yeah.
But perhaps one of the reasons why they are so efficient is that they're a matriarchy. they're run by the ladies.
Yeah. Yeah, the drones, sadly, they don't really do very much at all. They don't pollinate anything. They can't even feed themselves.
They do have a job.
Yeah, spread genetics out.
Would it not be, correct me if I'm wrong though, Steph, but could we not regard, in terms of the honeybee, as a hive or a colony, as really one single set of genes?
Exactly.
So really, it's an individual, a super organism. So the queen bee is essentially just the gametes or the ovaries, essentially, of the organism.
Exactly. When you think of bees, you can't think of individual bees, really. Yeah. It's like Steve said, you have to think of the super organism. And when you enter into the hive, you can see the different functions. If we could compare it to a human body, you can see the bees that would serve as the respiratory function. Mm. You could see the digestive system. You could see the womb system. You could see all the different parts working together cohesively as, you know, as one entity, essentially.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a more interesting and powerful way to look at it. And as you were talking earlier, Steph, I was thinking, generalizing, you're making some very interesting points about bees, and I was trying to think of that in a more general, in a sort of permaculture framework. And that in the way in which permaculture design, in which we're encouraging people to look at we encourage two things. One is to observe and interact. Mm. So you talked about how do you learn to work with your bees by observing them and
Definitely.
Then seeing how they behave and then working out how to interact with them and then seeing how they respond to that interaction. And then that's a feedback learning loop
that's
sympathetic. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that implies then the development of a two-way relationship, a give and take,
Definitely,
listen and respond, mutually beneficial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, what again? Permaculture teaches is that the natural world is just a huge interconnected web of mutually beneficial relationships.
Yeah, it's like a huge feedback system, isn't it?
Exactly right.
One of the principles is apply self-regulation and accept feedback, is it? I think
one
of my favourites.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right. And what you said, what was that word you used? The I, what was it?
Aini.
Which is that your definition of that included that very observe and interact, understand the two-way nature of all relationships.
The mutually beneficial interchange.
Dalimitri's put into the chat box, was that sesopossity is a word he's put in there, and then he's written the exchange of love.
Yes.
Yeah, love and labour as well. It's, you know, because we obviously have that exchange of, that interchange of love, but unless you adapt your behaviour accordingly, then it's, you know, it's... You need to build something constructive.
And start living out the action of love. It's an emotion, but it only becomes something tangible when you actually start living according to those actions and start putting it into play.
Yeah.
You know, you
can... mm-hmm.
I guess it's broadcasting a frequency, isn't it? Because I know some people who seem to be able to think their cats calm. They just look at them and think calm, loving thoughts at them, and it works really well.
That's how it works, come back to that frequency resonance,
you know, all of those energetics.
Speaking about how to build upon that interaction, that's really what I love about the Top Bar beehive. That was the first beehive that I mentioned in the introduction. It's like the upside down Toblerone. That really is founded upon that underlying ethic, you know, of allowing the bees to develop, you know, a system that works well for them, how they would live in the natural environment, but finding a way that we can work with them in kind of create an atmosphere whereby we can still kind of benefit from their Nectar services, but they get to live in a way that enriches them and facilitates communication and bee welfare, really.
And allows them to thrive. Mm.
Allows them to thrive, and also,
I've just been looking at some pictures of the top bar beehives, and they look more like a static caravan than a high-rise.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like a hollow log turned upon its side. And when you're constructing this hive, it's really easy to build. Anybody could build this hive. It's really, really simple. There's plans online.
We built two in a few hours,
didn't we? Yeah. And all you have to do really is provide the bees with this box and give them some bars. You place some bars on top of the box and just drizzle a thin layer of wax on top. And the bees essentially build their own comb, which is fantastic for them. You know, it's what bees do. You know, it's coming back to this idea that, you know, like allowing them to live in a way that's cohesive to their true nature. You know, with a traditional hive, a national hive, or a Langstroth hive, you know, typically you'd give the bees frames of foundation wax into which that they, you know, they build the cellular structure and build them out.
Which are bigger than what they would normally choose to build.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that they spend more of their energy making honey and less making wax.
Yeah.
So you're already forcing them to behave differently. That is the
difference. Exactly. To be more productive, isn't it?
To be more productive for us.
For us rather than for themselves. And, you know, the bees that come from these foundation wax prints, they're actually bigger than a bee would be naturally. And they're actually less resistant to the varroa mite, which is one of the reasons why bees are suffering with bee decline these days.
Yeah.
There's a lot of research nowadays to suggest that when bees are allowed to build their own comb, they actually build them smaller and they're a lot more resistant to the mite. And for many reasons, it's just so much better to have bees exercising those wax-making glands constantly, you know, because essentially you get to recycle the wax out of the hive, which reduces pathogens within the hive. Also, it's so much easier for bees to communicate within that structure. Because in the foundation wax in a national hive, there's thin strips of wire running inside it. And when bees communicate, everyone knows about the bee dance. You know, they dance in infinity symbols.
Yeah.
But when they do that, they actually vibrate the combs of the hive and send messages along the body of the hive. And if there's wire strips, they can't communicate efficiently. You know, the vibration is broken somehow.
So it's not just the electromagnetic radiation then, the very structure of the places we're giving them to live is interfering with their communications.
Yes.
Exactly.
A bit like what they're doing to humans.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I heard something interesting about the bee dance, the waggle dance, the other day, and it was just simply this, that apparently, because they, obviously, as you rightly say, they communicate where the source of nectar or pollen is and how far it is away. Apparently, it's being tested that if you feed bees cocaine, they exaggerate the quality of the nectar and make say that it's nearer than it really is kind of show off.
Oh my gosh!
And there's kind of a wider point, which is something which Michael Pollan. Apparently.
Who's been giving bees cocaine?
But I don't know how ethical it is. But anyway, this has been done, and this is what happened. But a wider point, though, it did amuse me, but a wider point, which is something which Michael Pollan has made in one of his books, and he's a writer, so I have a lot of time for. But it's really interesting on an aesthetic level that bees and humans, we agree about things. We are attracted very much to the same things.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that something you'd agree with? And
definitely.
We have the same aesthetic, really, as bees do.
Definitely. And it's probably because we've co-evolved, you know, with bees and how they've co-evolved with plants. We're part of that sacred symbiotic relationship, you know. It's the fruits that we like to eat. The apple tree creates the apple for us to eat it and disperse the seeds.
Yes.
And the flowers are desirable to bees so that, you know, they fulfill that role of pollination. Mm. It's interesting you say that thing about cocaine. Like, I've never heard that myself. But I have heard that the bees can actually discriminate the individual dancing techniques of different bees.
Wow.
So, for example, say Lucy.
Oh, not him. He's pissed again. Or something.
Well, she,
yes, of course.
So, for example, Lucy, if she just really loves dancing, so she'll fly into the hive and she might exaggerate the moves a little bit more than the pollen source actually is. And the bees will understand that. They'll be like, oh, that's just Lucy. She loves dancing. It's not that far away.
In a flamenco style. that's wonderful.
Yeah, so intelligent.
That's really wonderful. Yeah.
So everything, as well as being a general part of an organ within the organism, every single beer is nonetheless unique in the way it executes its function.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that fascinating?
No atom can take up the same space. That's what I've heard. So, every
beer still have individuality.
Totally,
even though
the same. But still some collective consciousness that binds them. Yeah.
Mm. So do we get just one layer in each of these top bar beehives, do we, rather than stacks of layers of honey?
They're not more beneficial to the bees, isn't it? You know, when you're moving, you know.
Yeah.
He's trying to imagine how it looks. Yeah. So the combs hang from the bars at the top down. So you can still have a line of, like a rack of pieces of toast or something. I don't know how to throw it.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it, actually. There's multiple bars that you provide the bees with, and they essentially build their comb down in like a U shape, really. Okay. And it's quite thick. It's like quite a thick panel. It's like I was saying earlier, the bees, you know, because they build their own comb, they actually build the cells multiple different sizes as well. You have small cells, big cells, depending on what they want to use the cells for. So it's really giving the power back to them to decide how to build their own home and how to function within that space, you know. But there's many different combs.
And are you finding, are you getting in touch with local beekeepers and finding that they're willing to take this on board?
Yeah, so a project that I'm involved in right now, I captured my first swarm last week. It's really simple, actually, to capture swarms. I was amazed how simple it was.
Was it hanging? Was it hanging from a tree branch? Was it? Or was it one of the
bush? Yeah, it was in a really spiky bush. And I was up at the community gardens in Garth with Jude. And I've been meaning to go up there for so long. And she phoned me up one day and she's like, Steph, today should be the day. Do come up. I'd like to talk to you about bees and top bars and all of this. And I was like, okay, today's the day. I'll go up there. Went up there, went into the gardens, and we could hear a buzz coming from around the corner where there was no hive.
She was just talking about capturing, how she'd love to capture a swarm, minutes before she went up to the garden. Yeah. Oh, I'd love to capture a swarm.
Nice piece of manifestation, well done.
Yeah, it was perfect, and we found this swarm in one of the bushes there, and so we jumped on it right away and got, we just got a big white sheet and a skep hive, and basically just cut the branches where the bees were situated and placed them inside the basket. And the thing is, as long as you get the queen, then the rest of the bees, they'll follow. And so when bees are swarming, they haven't really got very much to protect, so they're not very likely to sting you either. So, you know, as long as you're, you know, gentle and graceful or whatnot, you don't really need to have a uniform or a veil or anything, you know, just be very careful.
Is it right that it's not good to cast a shadow over them when you're working on them?
Do you know, I've never heard that, but I think that's a fair concern. I'd probably want to leave them in the sunshine.
They're
sense.
All about maintaining a core temperature of the hive, and any kind of slight variations on that.
Yeah, you want to keep them warm. But the reason why I said that, a project that I'm involved in now, really, I'm hoping to manifest another swarm, because I really want to try and bridge the gap between beekeepers that are currently practicing in the area. A lot of people tend to work with national hives, whereas I'm more familiar with top bar hives. I want to manifest another swarm so that I can keep both hives. I'd like to keep a national hive as well as a top bar hive, and basically just observe and interact with the bees in both of these structures and see which one benefits them the most, and kind of learn from my own experience and from what the bees can teach me, so that I can recommend people in future if they'd like to move into more of a balanced way, a more of an organic way, working with the bees. There are ways, really, of adapting a national hive to really suit a more balanced beekeeping framework. So you can actually allow the bees to build their own combs within national hive as well. So, you know, it's basically like a top bar hive within a national hive. That's kind of what I'd like to create. And then once that's established, I'd like to try and share that with beekeepers in the area and see if that's something that they might be interested in.
What other stuff did you learn in Peru that you might be trying to put in practice here that's different from what's done as standard?
Talking about capturing another swarm, you know, one of the things that we did learn is about splitting hives, you know, and understanding, you know, what that process is about, you know, and there's a huge amount of insight, you know, we got from doing, it was like 3 months, I think, altogether we were there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We were doing a couple of days with the bees and working on a farm, a demo farm that was building adobe greenhouses for high altitude communities.
Mm-hmm.
So just being on that piece of land and just being in contact with the guys that were running the NGO there, you know, being involved with the hives on such a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
and seeing that through, you know, over a few month period. I mean, we've got to taste, you know, a few different areas of beekeeping, mm-hmm. and, you know, to spend that amount of time with Jerry was just phenomenal. You know, he had such a plethora of experience and, you know, the amount of stories that he told us about his experiences and then mm-hmm. offered those experiences really, you know, for us to really have. It was just a really well-rounded introduction, mm-hmm. you know, I think, to the bee world. That has just sent us all in a direction that has definitely. Just given us total yeah. reverence for that.
And I think the main thing really that I'd like to help bring from South America is really the understanding of Aini. We've already spoke about that, but it's revisiting this connection with the land. You know, it's like Steve was saying earlier, people in Zimbabwe and people in the Andes, they know how to work together in community because they provide what they need for the community, you know, within themselves. And there's a level of respect there and a knowing that there's an interchange that is always happening. When we remove something from the land, you know, there's something that needs to be put back in its place, you know. And I guess that's partly what I'd like to try and bring over here from South America as well.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah. You know, likewise, I can relate that over to the kind of work that that we've been doing with medicine work and really kind of finding a deeper connection with ourselves, but it's like what Steph just said. It's about achieving a connection with the land on multiple different levels, and it's about giving back to the land. You know, where we were living in the Sacred Valley in the Andes, there's a very regular ceremony that the locals do, and it's almost like a daily occurrence where they do a ceremony called despachos or oferentas. And it's an energetic ceremony, and there's no kind of plant. The only plants that are involved are the medicinal and ritual and sacred juice of coca, which is really used to connect you with yourself and to connect you with the elements. But it's something that I'm sure would have been practiced here, you know, many hundreds or thousands of years ago, if all the people that were practicing those kind of things weren't burnt at the stake. But it's really giving back to the land in an energetic, symbolic way. And it's really quite a beautiful process where you kind of give thanks for everything that you've got. You give thanks that you have a healthy body or even if it's not fully healthy, for the parts of your body that are healthy, and that you have a mind and you can see and you can breathe and you can hear. And then you kind of give thanks to the earth, and you give thanks to the different elements and the mountains that protect us and the river that provides us with water, the land that gives us food. And it's really, and then you kind of give that offering back, you know, and you put all these, they use many different kind of elements and different items that symbolize like the richness of the earth. And they kind of put in like, you know, chocolate and wine and shiny things and colorful things to symbolize all the different.
This is all put in a little package, isn't it?
It's exactly. It's all put in a, all put in a package. Exactly. It's intention. Yeah.
Your intention, I think, is everything, you know, in so many ways. And especially, you know, with this as well, it's like you were saying, it can be whatever it needs to be, but ultimately it's that gratitude, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
And it comes
yeah.
up to that real honouring of the elements and where you are and then understanding them. Like, so.
And no matter what level you look at that, no matter if you're looking at it from purely a physical perspective and you're materialist, you know, to have that aspect of gratitude in your heart is going to impact in every aspect of your life. You know, gratitude practices are really, really powerful tool to help us, like, you know, look for the best in people and things and opportunities, you know. But of course, over there with the Quechua people and the Queros who live really high up in the Andes, they see it as it opens up a channel of communication and reciprocity and Aini with the elements, with the unseen realm. And you know, and they interact a lot with the apples, which are the mountain spirits. You know, they interact a lot with the sun, with the earth, and with all the creation that they see around them. But even if you're looking at it, for whatever level you're looking at it, I think just to bring that element of gratitude into our lives, and to really kind of look inwards and go, wow, there's so much around me to be grateful for, you know, and to integrate that into your daily practice as they do over there, these people with, you know, thousands of years old tradition. I think that's one thing that I feel that would be nice to bring back, an element from South America so that I feel anyone ritual, could do over here. Yeah, it's a ritual.
It's like a,
Like a good way to start and end the day. And I guess you're talking about doing the same thing effectively to the planet and the wider environment as you were talking about doing with the bees.
As above, so below, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. It encompasses all of creation, you know, all of existence, you know, if people don't like the word creation either, you know.
Recognising that we're part of a web of mutually beneficial connections and relationships, you know, so we're not in isolation around everything.
Definitely.
So we don't have to just attend to our needs by attending to the needs of community or attending to the needs of the planet. We're also attending to our own needs, but just indirectly.
Yeah. It's all interwoven, And it's the core like kind of catchphrase that might come with Aini, is I'll help someone today in the hope that they might help someone tomorrow. And that can be applied.
Maybe not even someone.
Or something, you know, but it can be applied to anything. You know, I'm gonna compost this rather than just chuck it in the trash.
Yeah.
You know, it can be applied to anything. You know, I'm gonna save this honeybee today, you know, or this bumblebee. That's, you know, it can be applied to anything. It's an ethos of how we live our lives. And the more, the deeper that we look into that and how we can apply that on a day-to-day basis and on a community level and a national level is really kind of the core infrastructure, the blueprint of how we can really change, I think, is on a global level is looking from, you know, looking place of empathy and compassion rather than what am I going to get out of it, you know? Yeah. It's a different way of looking at things.
Yeah, I think also that if an opportunity to help does arise in front of you, it's because you're generally in a position to help, and so why not, really? It's always better to be helpful than obstructive, I think.
It's that overriding principle of care, isn't it, I think? And, you know, looking at this whole spiritual currency that we've got of, you know, what we're paying attention to and what we're spending our time doing, you know what I mean? And it's, you know, it's really interesting to look at the words, you know, that are used and that we have got to use, you know, at the moment. And, it's a really important awareness to have, I think, especially currently and where we're finding ourselves, because I think a lot of people are being challenged and a lot of people are questioning, a lot of people are wanting to know some solutions, which I think is a great thing that you do in the show.
Got a question in the chat box from E. McFall. I thought it said, how do bees mate? But it actually says, how do bees mate?
Interesting process.
Yeah, it is quite an interesting process. So within the hive, there's the queen bee, and she's essentially like the womb or what?
The ovary of
the hive. And she's the only one that actually mates. The male bees within a hive, they're the drones, and they're the ones that kind of impregnate other queens, and that's their sole function in life, is to spread and disperse the genetics outward into the world, because bees are always working to expand, you know, it's wonderful to be around the energy, they're always looking to expand their resources and expand their genetics out into the wider world. So when they're in the position, when the hive's really full, they've run out of space and they're full of honey and nectar,
The queen endlessly lays eggs.
Endlessly.
That's correct, yes.
At the times of high nectar flow, she lays up to 1,200 eggs a day.
Whoa.
Like, it's incredible amounts of
and
eggs.
And each one of those eggs is then placed by a drone in a cell. That's right, in a wax.
Not by a drone. She places it. She lays the egg directly into the cell.
Okay, all right, so she's moving around inside the hive.
Yeah. And then it's the nurse bees, which are essentially the younger forager bees. They take care of the brood. And there's no difference between a queen bee and a forager bee other than diet. So every egg, except for the drones, starts off exactly the same. It's a fertilized egg. Mm. And then it's diet alone that creates a queen or that creates a forager. So if that egg is due to become a new queen, she'll be fed exclusively on royal jelly. Whereas the other ones, after 3 days, are fed pollen and nectar. So when it's time for the queen to fly and to mate, when the hive's really full, she'll exit the hive and she'll be followed with a little band of experienced foragers, and they'll lead her to a drone congregation area which is like the drone bar, you know, it's where all the guys hang out, just like for queens to fly by. Yeah. And then that's everything their lives have been geared up to. They've been waiting to see a queen their whole life. Mm. And then the drones will begin following her in flight, and they'll try and mate with the queen in midair. And she'll probably only mate with like a few, like between two or five drones. And it's quite a brutal affair, actually. The male, after fulfilling his duty, the queen will actually squeeze the drone and tear out his reproductive parts.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, and actually tear out his reproductive parts, and then he'll die having fulfilled his function. And then the queen will take
way to go.
Back to the hive, yeah. To begin laying.
Imagine that. Just spare a thought for that.
Sacrifice. So the queen is impregnated, and it keeps that sperm within its body
for
thousands and thousands of eggs.
Exactly.
And that can be up to, is it 12 years the queen can live?
That's the thing with royal jelly, because it is diet alone that separates the foragers. Typically, a forager will live for about 6 weeks, but a queen bee can actually live up to 12 years. Royal jelly is this amazing, miraculous, like, food of life. It's an amazing substance. Some people actually sell it, I know, in health food stores and things, but I would never produce royal jelly. I would never harvest it from the hive, and I really wouldn't recommend buying it. Although it really is an amazing substance, the point is the bees need that substance, and we don't, you know, and just to harvest that substance, you have to keep the bees in almost like a slave, like a role of slavery, because you have to constantly keep killing the queen so that the nurse bees produce excessive amounts of royal jelly to feed the new queen when she's when she's being made. And so it's keeping them in a state of ultimate confusion. I've been around a hive when the hive's been queenless. Before I'd even finished the inspection, I just knew something was wrong. It wasn't right. So I was saying earlier, the buzz of the bees, their vibration, you can feel it very much. And you can hear the differences in buzzes the more time you spend with them. And on this one particular occasion, I approached the hive and I could hear this. It was almost like a song coming from the hive, like a song of mourning. It was really, really sad. It was this state of hopelessness, you know. And immediately I knew that something was wrong. And after I inspected, I knew that the hive was queenless. And so just being around that, I felt really, really sad. Obviously, I could fix the problem being a beekeeper. You just bring them some fresh eggs. But imagine keeping bees in that state to produce something for us, medicine for us, you know. It's something that I don't really agree with. Although it is a magical substance, I wouldn't want to take it, really.
No, I think that if you're going to take that sort of thing, it should be for homeopathic use anyway, because you don't really need very much for that kind of application.
Definitely. I mean, there is an opportunity. So if the hive wanted to create a new queen, for example, so in a hive of bees, there's no one bee that's in control or dominates the decisions of the hive. So the queen, even though she's the queen bee, that's just a label that we've given her.
Queen with a small q.
Yeah, so it's essentially the whole hive that makes decisions, you know. So if the queen isn't laying appropriately, then the rest of the hive will decide to supersede her. And so they'll keep one of the eggs and develop her into a new queen and make that decision upon themselves. In those times, it is possible to take a little bit of royal jelly, just because they create around six queens, and only one of them is due to become a queen. So in that case, if somebody was very sick and they needed a little bit of medicine, I would ask permission for the bees to share some of that royal jelly and maybe take one cell to share with somebody. But, you know, it's only if the bees can afford to share it, and, you know, I'd rather not generally.
What happens if one of the half dozen queens is going to become a queen? What happens to the rest of them?
Yeah, well, basically, it's just the first one to get out, really. The first queen out of the cells, she leaves, and basically the queen bees in the cells, they give off like a little beep. They have like a little beeping sound. And so she moves around the hive and finds all the little beeps and essentially stings the other bees in the cells so that they die. Because there can only really be one queen in the hive.
There can only be one.
Only one queen.
That's right, yeah. We don't want any kind of dynasty establishing itself in the air. So what about the, I mean, I think it was you, Steph, who said that there's quite a lot of confusion over the sickness of the bees kind of as we know them in this country. What sort of what do you think it is causing them to be sick? Is it inapplicable housing only, or have they got other problems too?
Well, there's many reasons. Yeah, it's a really current topic nowadays. A lot of people realise that, you know, bees are declining, but I guess people aren't really that clear as to what's causing it. But there's a whole variety of problems really with what's faced, the problems that are facing the bees, and a lot of those problems apply to us as well. So one of the main things is they're actually running out of places to live. You know, we're destroying habitats of bees. The more that we create monocrops, just fields and fields, miles and miles long of endless, it's the desert for the bee, just one crop, which is due to be pollinated.
Sheep and grass we got out here.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yes, the sheep monoculture.
Yeah.
So I said already earlier in permaculture, we're really interested in celebrating diversity. It's mm-hmm. in the natural state is diversity.
Exactly.
The problem with your monoculture is you might have 40,000 hectares of oilseed rape all producing at the same time.
Exactly.
But once that stops producing, you then have nothing.
Absolutely nothing. It's a desert.
Literally a desert.
Yeah.
And that is a real problem, not just for the bees, but for all the invertebrates, especially in things that can't travel very far.
Exactly.
I also heard rumours that that people actually move loads of beehives to take advantage of the oilseed rape, and when it stopped flowering, they bundle all the beehives onto the back of a lorry and take it to a lavender crop or something. That can't help something like a bee, surely.
Well, in California, with all their almond trees and everything else, they do that on a huge scale.
Yeah, it's shocking. They call it migratory beekeeping. Mm. And they, you know, they have that huge crop of almonds, as you said, but all throughout the country, the whole system of agriculture is founded upon monocrops. And so after the bees have finished pollinating the almond crop, they'll move them, you know, thousands of miles on this long, epic journey across the country, kept in really terrible conditions.
Trucks, essentially.
Just full of chemicals and pesticides and miticides and fungicides. And actually, I've heard, I watched a documentary, there's a really good documentary on that called Queen of the Sun, and it actually explained how a lot of beekeepers in those instances harvest all of the honey from the bees and actually feed them high fructose corn syrup to give them energy to actually fulfill that role. But yeah, it's really destructive for the bees. Every time you move a hive of bees, they have to completely remap their field source. You know, they keeps them in a state of confusion or like not knowing where their home is, you know, all the time.
Although I've heard stories of people who do take their bees.
Yes.
I mean, they do. They take them up the hills in the Pyrenees. And,
and
there's a guy of that Suffolk I met, and he takes them on holiday with him.
Yeah.
He goes to the Pennines and sticks them up on the heather, and they love it. And then,
see, in that instance, that's a good thing. I think that could be a good thing because it's done on a small scale. You know, I think the difference is doing it on a mass scale.
Yeah, you can move it like 2 inches or, what is it, 2 miles?
Yeah. I'm sure that they appreciate that nectar flow as well, because in times, you know, even if you are growing a variety of different crops in your area, there could be certain times of the year when that crop is kind of drying up, and so you're actually providing ample food for them by moving them around.
It could be done in a very, very
sustainable way.
I mean, you can also relate it in the Himalayas. You know, there's a group of indigenous people there that, at a certain point in the year, they take it to a plateau that's high up, and they'll take the hives up, and basically all the bees pollinate the rhododendron bush, the rhododendron plant.
The mad honey,
and it creates a psychoactive reaction in the honey, and then they all get, kind of ceremonies, whatever.
Visionary experiences.
At last, a use for rhododendron ponticum.
Yeah.
I always looked at its commonness, because most of the plants that we get that are really common here, even if they are aliens, a lot of them have got, they tend to be survivors because they are useful to us.
Yeah.
Well, the balsam, I've noticed, the Himalayan balsam. I don't know what you think about this, but the bees love it. I mean, it's a very invasive plant. It's been declared public enemy number one.
Mm-hmm.
It's humming with bees.
Well, generally, bees really like weeds. Yeah, so things like thistles, bees adore, you know. It's really good food crop. Buttercups. You know, that's another thing. That's a really...
Dandelions.
Dandelions, all those beautiful flowers, you know, that... Once you reevaluate what a weed is, you know, and actually see it as something useful in the environment rather than seeing it as a problem.
And we're in a
every element performs its multiple functions.
I have noticed myself that the bumblebee, all these bumblebees we've got around here, they much prefer the wild plants to the cultivated ones. I mean, they are pollinating, somebody's pollinating the cultivated ones, but the ones that I see the bees around are the wild raspberries and the hogweed and the knapweed.
And they're often a lot more nutritionally dense for bees as well, which is, you know, they really need for their immune systems right about now, actually. You know, they need wild plants in their diets for sure. One plant that I would like to give a shout out for, though, is borage. Borage is a wonderful bee plant. And since this is a show about solutions, one simple solution, really, to creating healthy, balanced habitats for bees is just planting more borage. It's a wonderful, wonderful plant, and bees love it.
Easy solution, folks. Borage grows in most places, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The great thing about
comfrey,
borage...
too.
Comfrey. Well, they're in the same family, aren't they? And the thing about borage, so the nectar stores of the borage will refill. After being fed on by a bee, it'll actually refill itself within 2 minutes. So a bee can go back there 2 minutes later and refill the nectar stores.
Isn't nature amazing? I just love examples of how generous the system is. This stuff is coming from nowhere. It's coming from light and water. Just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What about the mite? You sound like you're presumably approaching this as organically as you can. Are you finding? Well, I guess you're only just starting, aren't you? Really, but I guess you're expecting to find that a healthier population may withstands the mite better, and possibly on sick plants attract pests and diseases. Healthy plants tend much less so.
Yeah. So. In South America, where I learned beekeeping, I never actually saw an instance of the varroa mite. So I was really, really lucky to kind of learn on those hives in particular. Coming over here to the UK, though, I have been made aware that the varroa really is a bit of a problem over here. And most bees now actually, to a lesser or stronger extent, have to suffer with that mite. But there are natural organic ways of treating varroa mite within the hive. So one thing would be to urge the bees to build their own comb first and foremost, so that they can actually protect themselves against the mite. They actually build smaller cells so that the mites can't fit inside with the bee, and so that decreases the probability of suffering with the mite. Also, if you have a hive that has a problem of varroa, you can use essential oils like homeopathy. To actually diminish the varroa problem. I don't know if the exact amounts and quantities, but you can use tea tree oil diluted in water, basically soaked on paper towels, and leave that on top of the bars within the hive, and that will decrease your varroa mite count quite substantially in a short period of time, actually.
So what was that? I missed that. What was that, leaving it on top of the hive?
Yeah, so tea tree oil. There's a few other essential oils. There's a link on it on the Aini Beekeeping Facebook page. Basically tea tree oil watered down. I think it's like 10 times with water. And you soak a paper towel and then leave it at the top of the hive on top of the bars. And that will actually decrease your varroa problem.
Brilliant. And also, one of you, I think it was you, Anthea, was telling me that bees are related to ants.
Was it? It's Andrea.
Andrea, yeah. Somebody did.
Was that maybe Steph? I don't remember having a conversation with you. But
no, I didn't mention it, but they do share a common ancestor, don't they?
I think you might have
done nothing. Yeah, they did diverge at some point in the evolutionary history. And it's quite easy to see because they both do work within a similar structure. It's a superorganism.
Well, similar faces as well, haven't they?
I wonder, do you know which came first, the ants or the bees?
The ants. The bees came fairly late, relatively later than you'd think, along the evolutionary time frame.
I've got 300,000 in my head.
And because many plants that were insect pollinated were pollinated by beetles.
That was it,
That came a lot earlier. They think there's at least 3 million, they've identified 3 million species of beetle, and there could be as many as 8.
Wow.
Something like that. Because they've been around a really long time. So the bee is definitely newer than that. Yeah.
And I can imagine back then when the beetles used to pollinate the plants, they would have been less colourful, and probably the smells wouldn't have been as rich as they are today. They would have been quite different.
You talked about co-evolution. So this is something that Michael Pollan talks about in his book, The Botany of Desires, and it fascinates me. But he points out, of course, that before there were insects, in terms of the evolutionary timeline, there were no flowers.
Yeah.
Because a flower is a co-evolution between the insect and the plant. Mm-hmm. The flower is a reflection, it's a mirror of whatever it is the insect wants to see to make it do the pollination thing.
To mate with them, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah, to partner up with them. Yes,
yeah, so it's very, very, very interesting to start to think about that. So it's another really powerful example of our mutually beneficial relationships that the very mechanism of evolution is it evolves through interactions, through relationships. You can't have one without the other.
It's also showing really nicely how the complexity of the whole system from whenever it was 4.8 billion years ago continues to become kind of more intimate and interrelated to produce ever more complex and competent structures, of which we at the moment appear to be the exception.
Well, we're working very hard at unravelling that, yes, because we've sort of failed to actually see that that's the very mechanism. We see it as something to be exploited rather than understanding that it's something that we're part of. Mm-hmm. You know, humans are almost behaving like an autoimmune virus. We're attacking the very ability of the system to regenerate, you know.
Yeah. Well, amazingly enough, we've come to, it's about 10:30, so I think we've probably earned ourselves a wee break and a couple of tunes.
Great.
But I think that was a very interesting chat on bees.
Thank you.
It was very popular with Nick Nomick, who says, that's great news, now I can leave all the weeds where they are, the missus will be happy with that. So well done, there's peace in one household there. So what I'll do is I'll put on a couple of tunes so we can have a bit of a break, and then we'll come back and maybe have a word with Ollie about the indigenous healing techniques, which I'm sure will be just as useful. So I'm going to bung on the Asian Dub Foundation for the people. Here it is. It's called Colour Line. It's got a great lyric to it, folks, and we'll be back with you in 7 minutes or so. That was Rebel Yell from Billy Idol, and you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we're seeking solutions with Steph Jackson, Ollie Boone, Steve Jones, and Andrea. Sorry about that earlier. Andrea Prophet. We've been talking about bees, but now we want to shift our perspective a little bit to some of the other learning that went on when you were all out in Peru, because I guess you must have picked up some of the stuff with Ollie. And you're going to be talking about indigenous healing techniques, Ollie. What do you think's the basic difference between the way they try and heal people and the way we do it here?
Gnosticism in itself, a lot of people, when they hear the word Gnosticism, they think of Christianity, and it might be slightly misleading to think of that. Gnosticism stems from the Greek word gnosis, which basically means knowing. It's not a belief system as such. It doesn't revolve around beliefs. It's a system that enables experience, so wisdom can be formed from that experience. And what the teachers from these ancient traditions do is they facilitate a space in which the student can learn directly from the experience themselves without the master directly saying, this is that, this is this. They facilitate and open up an opportunity so people can have direct learning experience from the different tools that they utilize. So now we've got a basic understanding of those two terms, animism and Gnosticism.
Can you just repeat your summary of animism? Because I'm afraid I forgot to press the big green button, which I do occasionally, so people might have missed that. So just revisit animism for me, if you could. And apologies for that, folks. I'm sure you're used to me doing that after 4 years. God damn it.
No,
carry on.
So I was just going to explain it, but before we delve into some of the indigenous healing techniques that I've been studying with in the Amazon, I'm not sure how much didn't get recorded, but before we go into that, I'd just like to kind of put forward a couple of notions, and the first one is animism. Basically means it's the idea, the notion that everything, to a certain extent, has a level of consciousness on some level or plane. Even seemingly static, inanimate things such as rocks, tables, chairs, plastic things, like footballs.
Everything's vibrating, isn't it?
Exactly that. So you go into the atomic level, and you notice that that everything is vibrating, is moving at incredibly fast rate, and it essentially it has a frequency. It has a specific frequency which it resonates at, which is really what you're talking about. Which it's another notion that would have to kind of go into. But before we start talking about consciousness, there's a lot of people regurgitate the words of Rick Strassman or Graham Hancock, but there's a big notion that consciousness now isn't how it was previously thought, that it was generated within the brain, within a kind of almost mechanic-like process, and it's generated within the brain. When the brain dies, consciousness dies. There's a new and evolving and more exciting notion, which is also cohesive to what indigenous traditions speak about all over the world, that the brain almost operates that of a TV set. So it's a receiver of consciousness, and it's a transmitter of consciousness. Now, it's interesting. So if we think about consciousness within that light, we can almost perceive consciousness as a form of frequency. So if we perceive consciousness as a form of frequency, and that everything, according to the philosophies of animism, has its own individual frequency, then everything can be essentially communicated with to a certain extent, which is what many of the ancient traditions agree with, and they all interact with these on different levels. So going back to your original question, Dr. Rock, about what's the difference between Western way of treating disease or disease and the indigenous traditions that I've been studying with in the Amazon. In the West, we like to kind of compartmentalize conditions. We like to look at conditions and go, ah, okay, you're having this system, you're having this symptom, so I'm going to give you this, and this is going to treat this symptom. And it's a very kind of narrow view of looking at why the illness arised in the first place. They often try to treat the symptom rather than to really get down to the roots and find out why it arised within the human body in the first place. So it's really a kind of system which doesn't really take into consideration that there's not many crossovers between psychology and the operations of the human psyche and emotions and the suppression of emotions and the suppression of traumas with the manifestation of illnesses that develop within people. Where in indigenous society, indigenous communities that I've been working with, it's almost the exact opposite. Immediately upon the diagnosis process, with the Shipibo tradition, they'd bring you into the ceremony, because in ceremony, using the tools that they've been given, that they've co-evolved with for a number of years, according to the Shipibo, and I can attest to the experiences myself, and it's very difficult to, if you've never experienced any kind of medicine, any kind of plant medicine used in a ceremonial context for the purpose of healing, then it might be quite difficult to kind of get a grasp on how it's used. But so these plant medicines, they enable us to see. They enable us to see in a different way in what we're normally used to seeing. They enable us to see with what's used in many of the what's called in many of the traditions all over the world, the pineal gland. So you're operating with something that we work with when we sleep, in a completely dark room, how we perceive light and vision, and we perceive distance. When there's no light that's interacting with in a room, we're using the pineal gland, which is an organ that's located in the center of the brain. This actually has a retina, a cornea, and a lens. It's been thought that it was one of the original eye, from when we might have been in kind of fish form. And different earlier forms of our evolution that's kind of evolved around it.
I think there are still some crocodilians that still have a vestigial pineal and a kind of a thin skin on the top of their head.
Exactly. So I'll run you through briefly, like, the kind of diagnosis process and how the Shipibo would work, how my teacher Don Enrique works. So he'd bring in, traditionally, going back, say, hundreds of years, the Shipibo would bring in the patient, and traditionally only the curandero, which means healer, would drink this brew, ayahuasca, which is called the vine of the souls or the vine of the dead, and they'd look into the patient. So they'd look into the patient, and then they see patterns, these geometric patterns, which anyone who might have had any kind of psychedelic experience might have experienced patterns. The patterns, according to the Shipibo, are the underlying matrix that makes up reality. And each one of us has our own individual pattern, which is kind of imprinted on us through the placenta, the point of birth, during the whole time in the womb. Now, during the ceremony, the curandero would sing, and through the songs, they would open up your patterns, and they'd notice within the patient, the patterns would appear contorted or twisted in certain areas that correspond to certain organs. When through the song, after they've seen this, they then enter, according to the Shipibo, and again, what I've experienced myself, is plant kingdom, and it's the realm in which they can attune their frequency to communicate directly with plants. I know some of you might see that as quite a strange concept, but
it is something we've talked about before on the show. And I mean, I've mentioned before that the very recipe for ayahuasca is really, really complicated and has confused a lot of anthropologists in the past, and almost whoever they've asked where this complex information came from, they say the plants told us.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I was just about to go on to then, and their process of healing. So after they have their patient in the ceremony, they've drank, they've looked into the patient's patterns, what are called kine, in the Shipibo language. They've opened them up, and then they've entered the plant kingdom. Now, then what happens is the plants would offer themselves to that patient, specifically to that patient. There'll be a plant, or sometimes a series of plants, which will speak to the curandero, which will tell them, they basically sacrifice themselves. I can help this person. I can help them. I'm located in this position of the jungle. If you take me with this preparation for this amount of time following this diet, I will be able to heal this patient. And according to the Shipibo, this is how they've developed their vast and huge knowledge library, kind of almost like a living database of plant medicines. It's not through, you know, how anthropologists might have us believe through the, you know, the endless kind of experimentation of, oh, well, let's try this with this, let's try that with that.
Yeah, right.
Observation too of how animals use it.
Exactly.
How do they record this information? Do they write it down, or is it an oral tradition?
Well, yeah, typically it's an oral tradition where knowledge is passed down from master to student. But I mean, as my teacher told me, you know, it's not the master that really teaches you; it's the plants that teach you directly. Because for what one plant might work for one person, it might be different for another person, and that other person might need another one. So that's one way in which they've recorded it. Another way in which they've recorded it is actually through their textiles, which I can talk a little bit about later. Which I can maybe use this as an opportunity to plug our project. The Roots Project, which we've recently set up, which is importing indigenous textiles from the Amazon and from the Andes. And we're basically telling the story of those textiles and the communities that are behind them. We're interviewing the elders. And hopefully next year we're going to be bringing some elders over here to do talks at different festivals. Another way how they encode the messages from the plants is through the songs that the plants teach them. And they embroidered these in very intricate woven textiles, and they decorate their homes with them. Throughout the healing process, they actually paint it on the patients using a paint that's very kind of similar to henna. It's a seed from a tree.
And these patterns really do look like frequencies. They've got a whole lot. I should have had some photos off you when I saw you, because they were lovely bits of cloth.
Well, okay. I can certainly upload some. I can send you a link on the chat room now, so any listeners can take a look for themselves.
Oh, great! Because they're intensely geometric, but at the same time, some of them, Well, they kind of look random, but they're not. You know, when you look, you can see the pattern, and you can see that what's being projected is a complex vibration of some sort.
Exactly. So, yeah, going back to your original question, how does the Western approach to healing differ from that of indigenous communities? It differs in the approach that it's holistic. It's not looking at merely the physical outcome of the illness. It's looking at it works at the level of spirit, of it works at the core kind of energetic components as to what's contributed to that illness, to that disease. And what you'd find typically when using these sacred plant medicines is that there's usually there's maybe about two or three different causes as to why illness arises in people. One of which is the suppression of emotions, suppressions of strong emotions that in this culture over here, we have a tendency to bottle up, to put away. You know, we don't want to look at it. So I'm going to just ignore it and it'll go away. Well, those emotions, they get stored just like kind of energy, any kind of energy that's not sufficiently vented or released or expressed in the multitude of ways as humans that we can express our emotions, get stored within our energetic body, within our energetic blueprint. This is how medicines like ayahuasca, yahe, San Pedro, mushrooms used within the right context, even though they're just tools and we can reach this state through our everyday waking state if we have the right tools, this is how they have the potential to heal illnesses and diseases very quickly. But sometimes they can do it just by themselves. If we catch it at a stage where it's at the energetic level and it hasn't manifested into illness, then it can heal things like cancer and Parkinson's disease and you know that
addiction to chemicals. I've been reading as well, very high percentages of people who go out say addicted to something like cocaine or heroin, which is, or perhaps even sugar, come back and it's cleared, as pretty much was outlined by Graham Hancock. I enjoyed his talks on ayahuasca.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think the ultimate, you know, part of this is the fact that the plants, whatever it is that's outside of yourself, you know, it comes back to that belief and that real willingness to really surrender, you know, to what is happening within that person and that individual that's going through that challenge or whatever it is at the time. You know, and those plants have the ability to show that person and to really, you know, give that understanding, you know, if it's willing, and that exchange, again, it goes back to what we were talking about before, is there to, you know, facilitate that happening, you know. But intrinsically, it's that consciousness within that individual that is really transforming.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Artist formerly known as Graham has put in the chat box that he agrees that plants have all the answers to disease because Mother Nature has done all the synergistic research and we ignore that at our peril.
They open up a level of consciousness that enables a clear sight, like you were saying with the pineal gland and that you know, whole kind of synergy with the eye. You know, really it is seeing and it's allowing that vision, you know, and that higher level of vibration, like a lifted level, because everything has that frequency. So, you know, by rights, you know, the higher frequency is going to pull up a lower frequency element, you know, so it does aid that in so many ways. And it's so important, I think, for this knowledge to be shared and to be really embraced, you know, and different ways of looking at different perspectives, because that's really what we've got is the perspective. You know,
and I think that proving can be done by individuals really quite easily. I mean, we've talked quite a lot with Synchro and with Fred Gillam about communicating with trees, and I was fortunate enough to spend a good amount of time last year in a piece of ancient oak woodland. It's probably been oak woodland for like 30,000 years or something, and actually just walking into the place kind of imposes itself on you, and I found that sitting in it, just by paying attention, you suddenly become aware that there is something coming back to you. It's just that we've got so much noise and trauma around us that we perhaps just don't notice it.
Exactly, you know, and to relate that back to some of the techniques that the Shipibo have developed, you know, as their culture has co-evolved with the use of this medicine, and their language has even co-evolved with the use of the medicine, a process in the jungle that's called La Dieta, which like the diet, it's a process in which indigenous peoples, it's used pretty much universally throughout the Amazon. I don't know of any indigenous group that doesn't use diet in the process of learning. It's how they gain, like, almost, how they get a direct communication with the plants, and they learn directly from the plants. And the diet, essentially, it's where you enter a contract with the plant, where you agree to withhold from eating certain things, withhold from doing certain things over a specified period of time. So you'd, say for instance, I was about to start a diet with rosemary. I'd take a part of the rosemary. I'd give an offering to the plant. I'd sit with it. I'd ask permission, and I'd take a little part of the root bark, and I'd put it in a drink, and I'd drink the rosemary the following day while I fasted, and then I'd enter an agreement with the rosemary plant. I'm going to diet you for this amount of time, say 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And while you enter that, you basically, the idea is to completely sensitize your body. You cut out any form of stimulants. And it's very similar to the diet that precedes the medicine work, if anyone's ever taken part in any ceremony. So it's basically no sex, no sugar, no alcohol, no meats. In many diets, there's no fruits. So it's probably easier to say the things you can eat rather than the many things that you can't eat. It's the diet usually... is made up of rice, yuca, plantain, certain types of fish, and lime, which you need to keep up your vitamin C levels. So there's no salt throughout that diet, which can be pretty difficult. There has to be other means of being able to retain water. So throughout that process, when you've completely sensitized your body, you've cut out any external stimulants, and you're consuming this plant on a regular basis, you can feel on a very subtle level what impact and what feeling that plant's doing to your body. And then this, used in conjunction with ceremonies, enables you to meet that plant, enables you to meet the spirit of that plant. And that the spirit of that plant, they often have very important messages that they have to share with us, each of them individually. And I find one of the most intriguing aspects of the diet, it doesn't matter if you're from London or if you're from, you know, Bronny Garth in Wales, the plants always show themselves in the same manifestations. They might have one or two, or some of them might have four or five, but they always have a specific characteristic and manifestation of how they appear to you. And you know, and this could, I'm sure this kind of thing could be done almost on a double blind or triple blind study. But it's, each one of them has a specific personality as well, which you encounter then, and each one of them has specific gifts and ways how they interact with you. It's something that I'm sure our ancestors would have been very much in communication with, over here. This kind of process, it's done all over the world. It's not just done in the Amazon. In the Himalayas, there's a technique that they use that we call tree gong, which is basically, it's very similar to qigong, where you're actually using it to connect with the tree, to connect with any kind of plant, to connect with anything really. And where you're having an interaction, you're having an aini, going back to that Andean like kind of word from earlier, having a reciprocity, a mutually beneficial interchange of energy, which opens up communication. And you know, I think the times that we're living in today, this is something that our culture is it's a sickness that lies with our culture, which, you know, Graham Hancock spoke about a lot. It's really that detachment, the separation, that we've severed that connection with spirit. And it's just important for people to know that it's there, you know, that realm is there, and the plants, they want to help, and they're waiting for us, you know. There was a beautiful group. I remember a story one of my friends shared with me, and that they were working with a group in Spain, and they decided, after going to the Amazon, they decided to go and work with the oak tree. And they did a diet with the oak tree, and like they kind of waited, and they, you know, they kept doing ceremony, and then after a month, the oak tree came to them, and they were like, "I've been waiting for you for so long, I've got so much to share with you," and then there was this whole kind of, you know, there was this interaction and you know, many things were learned. But, you know, with the way how we've been conditioned in the West, with how you know, the likes of Richard Dawkins and you know, the popular views on how the reductive materialist science, you know, will tell us that we are merely physical kind of meat robots.
Although even materialists, I mean, the queen of sciences, physics, has recognised that consciousness is somehow a critical role to play, although I'm not sure how far they've got in finding out what that role is.
Exactly, and if they keep looking in the material and merely solely in the material, then they're going to be pretty hard done to find anything that's tangible. You know,
they built one sodding great machine to look at it on the physical, haven't they? That
yeah, and spending insane amounts of money to build these big, you know, hadron colliders to try and find these tiny particles that they feel is going to solve, you know, the world's questions. But when really this, we could kind of transfer this back over to the concept of Gnosticism, where it's not something, you know, when you smell a flower, you know, when you see something beautiful, when you hear an amazing piece of music, you know, this isn't something that you can intellectually explain to someone. You might be able to explain certain elements and the components of what goes into that sound or that smell or what you're seeing, but it's a knowing, it's an internal knowing or gnosis or experience that you've experienced in yourself that is only that's your reality, it's your truth.
And, you know, it is actually the only true knowledge, isn't it?
Exactly that. Yeah, you know, we can read as many books as we like, and the books help, you know, but the books. And the documentaries and the conversations, got to remember that they catalyze an opportunity for growth, for experience, you know, to grow from that thing. And only then when we embody it, can we truly like learn from that experience, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Well, these are kind of experiences that I suspect that every group of individuals on the planet has had at one point or another. Like, we all had a tribal existence. We are all First Nation people. It's just that some of it's been more successfully, it's been swept under the carpet more successfully in some places than others.
Exactly. I mean, you look at the correlations with indigenous societies all over the world, and each and every one of them that I know, you know, so many of them have perhaps kind of forgotten their original ways, and they're still kind of grasp at what little does remain within the wisdom teachings, because many of the colonialism, they had a very direct focus of wiping out those who were practicing medicine, who were the wisdom keepers. But if you look at the correlations all over the world, they all have this tradition where they have a connection with the elements around them. Whether they use the tools of drumming or meditation or dance in some instances, or plants. It's, you know, they're all different tools. There's many streams that lead to the same river. And there's many different points of access, you know, and how we can do this. But yeah, and this culture over here, you know, it really kind of saddens me to see how the ridicule that's been imposed on it, you know, the ridicule that's been, oh, it's all superstitious, it's all nonsense. Well, if it is all nonsense and superstitious, how is it that universally, you know, that there's been effective methods of healing that have been implemented for thousands of years before modern, you know, Western science has come into play? You know, it's that interaction between mind and body is something that we've severed, you know, and whether or not it's the placebo effect is at play there. What's important to recognize is that the placebo effect is powerful, when they did the whole medical school, I think they spend about a day in like the 7 years of training working on the placebo effect, when really the placebo effect is responsible. You know, I think Bruce Lipton brought up that was done with MIT, that it's responsible for a third to two thirds of all healings is down to the placebo effect.
Fundamentally, if a human being heals, it's because the human being has healed itself.
Exactly.
There might be props and encouragement and all that kind of stuff, but ultimately it's us. And I mean, the placebo effect, I really enjoy watching videos about that, although there ain't too many of them about. It is a truly miraculous thing, but I mean, they say that on average it works on about 30% of people, but in some cases it's up as high as 70%. And I even, the ones I like most are the surgeons who decide that placebo effect can't possibly be operating where surgery is, and yet when they actually do the research and try operating on some people and not on others, they don't tend to see a statistically significant difference between those they did operate on and those that they just created the illusion of it, which suggests to me that the consciousness is drinking in the stimulus, whatever it is, and making its own response, really.
Exactly. It's not about kind of if it's a placebo effect or not. It's how can we work with that powerful tool? How can we work with the placebo effect?
Yeah.
You know, with the aid of plants, with the aid of ceremony in some instances, and even the kind of ritual of people going to the doctor in this country with the white coat and their response to that. And, you know, many people feel better even on the way to the doctors. Mm. But I think, With the use of these tools, which enables us to change our perspective and give us a very direct means of observing why illness or imbalance has occurred within the person, within the psyche, within the body, that in itself is, many of the indigenous teachers will humbly say it's not me that's healing them, it's themselves. They're healing themselves. The plants are helping them, but I'm really facilitating a space for them to look inside themselves.
Do you actually find that the people who experience this kind of treatment, do you find it opens them up sort of mentally as well as physically? Do you find that they're struck by the kind of magic of the situation?
Well, most definitely, because when you kind of grasp the notion that the mind and body are interlinked, and if someone's going there with physical ailments, and they're coming away, they're going into these ceremonies and actually seeing for themselves, you know, the reason of why this thing has developed, you know, whether it be a trauma from when they were a small child and they have no conscious recollection of it, or whether it be a, you know, being angry like a few weeks ago, you know, it's seeing that and firsthand and having the opportunity to release that. It's all about achieving a balance within oneself. No, it's all about doing that. So that's going to impact on every level of your being, on your spirit, on your mind, on your soul level. It's essentially the path of medicine is about becoming a fuller person. It's about really realizing our fuller potential and how we can step into that. And all the medicine does is help us to show what blockages we put in front of ourselves.
And allows us to see it for the benefit of all creation as well, because you really get insight into creation, you know, through these tools that are available. They give you access, you know, in my experience, which is the only thing I can speak from, you know, to a more interconnected existence in reality.
Totally.
To yourself,
you know? In healing yourself, you're essentially healing the rest of us, because we are all connected.
Exactly. It's a selfless act, because you heal, you know, the impact of you, you know, shedding your anger and your guilt and your depression. That's going to impact on your family and your friends and all of those around you. It's going to make their life a lot easier.
Everything you come into contact with.
Yeah, exactly. Everything you come into contact with.
Essentially, it's peace of mind, isn't it, in a sense?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and the plants have been here a lot longer than we have. It's a very interesting consciousness to be accessing.
It is, yeah, absolutely. We were talking about that earlier when we were talking about the evolutionary timeline, and we're really new to this game. Plants have been around for 70 million years, something like that, and we have been around 100,000, you know, whatever, but hominids, half a million or something. It's not, we're pretty new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ancient wisdom.
And part of a cycle, you know, and part of a big cycle, many cycles.
And plants help, you know, whatever, build the soil and build the atmosphere and build all of those interconnections on it. They drive ecosystems. They're incredibly.
I was going to mention before, The Sacred Science is a documentary that we all have watched, and you know, you guys have been in contact with the guys that run the Paititi Institute over in Peru. But The Sacred Science documents, I think it's 8 people going through a medicine journey, essentially. And I think for anyone listening, if they want to watch something that documents
you know, experiences of people that are going through these different medicines and ailments and challenges or whatever, you know, on a mental level, but also a physical level, you know, on all levels. It's really worth checking out.
Yeah, I'm just going to link to that in the chat there. So any listeners, if they're interested in watching that, yeah, they basically just take 8 people from the West who have serious medical conditions, you know, ranging from prostate cancer, Parkinson's, Crohn's disease, IBS, and they basically they observe the process. It's a very interesting documentary where they just film the process over the month and all the different layers that these people kind of break away from themselves. And yeah, I mean, with some amazing results. You know, you imagine after a month, just 1 month of being in the Amazon rainforest, you know, 5 out of 8 of these people walk away with the results that they want. You know, it's, you know, some of them healed very quickly, like diabetes, no problem. You know, was that like
2 weeks?
Like 2 weeks, and he's back home. You know, and still to this day, he's.
That again points out that really the basis for all of this stuff is consciousness. It's our own. It's our own animal spirit that's kind of building it into us. I was told by one of the guests that I had on the show, I can't remember who it was, that basically all of the inconvenience, all of the damage that we suffer later in life is quite often inflicted on us by the time we're 7 or 8.
Yeah. It's very true. I mean, I remember my first experience with the medicine. It took me back to a time when I was perhaps 4 years old, and I had no conscious recollection of this in my waking life. You know, if someone would have said, "Oh, do you remember that?" No, there's no way. And you know, it showed at me like I was watching a movie, and it was a point when my dad was really nasty to my mum, and he was leaving me, Basically showed me this as if I was actually watching a movie, and then it showed me how the impact of that was affecting my life today, and how through my actions, and it was stemming them back to this suppressed emotion. And then it goes, well, now you know this, you have the opportunity to forgive him and release this. It's like, would you like to do that? I was like, yes, please, you know, yeah, get rid of that. You know, I don't want that. And it did. It literally felt like something left me. You know, it was like a density that had been in my body.
That's brilliant that you mentioned that, because Synchro and I will be doing a ceremony at the Conscious Tribal Gathering, which basically physically reconnects people to the electromagnetic matrix, back to earth, air, fire, water and ether. And the words of the ceremony are actually forgiving mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and all those who have used the tools of manipulation and all of that. And yeah. I'm always amazed. I've been doing that ceremony for 15 years now, and I still speak the words with immense gratitude every time I do them. But it sounds like a very kind of, it's going to be a resonant, if you come and take part in it, it's going to be hopefully pretty resonant experience. It touches on so much of this stuff. And one of the things that I was really interested in you saying was that originally it was only the curandero who took the ayahuasca, whereas now it seems to have become a bit of a habit for people to be handing it out just a little bit willy-nilly in some cases.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's. I mean, the reason, one of the reasons why more and more people are taking it now, of course, is because there's much more. It needs to be out there, and the medicines. You know, the medicine is telling these curanderos to go and teach Westerners, because it's a point where it's a kind of all systems go. We need to try and get this stuff like fixed immediately before the whole world collapses, you know, and everyone collapses with it. So that's one of the reasons why it's become where more kind of curanderos are opening their doors to teaching Westerners. However, with that, with this huge influx and the tourism, in, especially in Iquitos, becomes a whole industry of charlatans, of people who are jumping on the bandwagon, who are really kind of taking advantage of tourists who really have put no kind of research or effort into finding anyone who's good and reputable and who has integrity.
Drug tourism,
exactly.
Thing like we've seen before.
It's a long time to learn how to walk those worlds.
Yeah, it does.
To be honest, you know, moving into those sort of circles, it's a very much a conscious decision to go down those roads. And, you know, a lot of people over in those indigenous communities take that for a specific reason, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a real clear intention going into that space and understanding what it means to start opening those doorways, you know, because it does open doorways and it does give you a very different perspective on things, you know, and sometimes it's a harsh reality, you know, it's not exactly an easy path to choose, really, a medicine path, because you do have to face your shadows and you do have to face all of those dark nights of the soul and whatever you want to call it, you know, so... You know, it's a choice, and it's a conscious choice to make those decisions and to come into your heart space and to really go into that space with integrity and to draw that kind of element in to guide you through that process as well.
I love that.
So
that,
the responsibility comes back to you always, you know, to create that integrity in your truth and in your space, you know, to go into there and follow the road.
I love that Charis Matthews lyric, which says, "When faced with my demons, I clothe them and feed them, and I smile. Yes, I smile whilst they're taking me over." Well, look, we're now at 11:20, so I think that we should probably play another couple of tunes and then have a chat with Steve. But that was really great. I'm really looking forward to all of your talks. I am. I think we're going to be having a great weekend next weekend.
Yeah, it sounds great. Fantastic.
So before we go to the tunes, I'll remind people they're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. And we've been speaking just then with Ollie Boone, just a little bit of a glance across the surface, really, of indigenous healing techniques. And earlier on, we were talking with Steph and Andrea about ethical beekeeping. And coming up next is housing cooperatives and basically how to do it, and probably a bit of permaculture as well from Steve Jones. But in the meantime, I am going to play, as soon as I can spot it, yeah, I'm going to play the Buffalo Skinners and Rosie. So we'll have a little bit of that southern music, and we'll be back with you in about 6.5 minutes or so, folks. Thanks very much to everybody, the guests and the listeners, for all being there. We really appreciate it. Georgia Satellite's there, and I don't know, because I really don't know. And before that, the Buffalo Skinners and Rosie, and we're joined back on the line this time by Steve Jones, hopefully. Steve.
Hi there.
You seem to have done a remarkably good job of researching and setting up communities that actually last rather than collapse. I've spent 3 or 4 years now moving from community to community, and many of them are young. What do you think are the basic most important points you've discovered in all of your experience? You have 15 minutes.
you need a plan, and you need an idea that's bigger than yourselves.
Absolutely.
There we go. 14 minutes and a half left.
Absolutely sorted.
You need something that unifies you and gives you direction, and just having affordable housing or running a business together, something isn't necessarily enough. We spent 3 years, Chicken Shack, the housing cooperative, which was the first one that was actually involved in forming and starting, which is now coming up to its 20th scary anniversary this on the 1st of August.
My God, was it that long ago?
But we spent kind of 2 or 3 years having the idea and scratching around, and like a lot of groups, getting close but not taking off, not quite reaching that takeoff point, you know. And that's quite a good analogy, really. You know, a plane or whatever doesn't leave the ground until it gets a significant momentum. All the conditions have to be right, and you can get close to that. And we did that repeatedly, but we didn't quite take off. And often that was because we were too malleable. We were too ready to sort of try and meld our ideas with other people to create a sort of, you know, to build a group or to create a critical mass. And actually, as we went further into it, what we realized was the more selective we were and the more specific we were about what we wanted and what was the function of the community and what did we want to get out of it, etc., then that made it easier for people to know whether it was something they wanted to be involved with or not.
That's really great, because you're kind of following the bees, and B, because the conversation I had about Brahan Law last week implied to me that that's exactly what's needed, is that people did have their own levels of responsibility and their own relationships, and people were occasionally required to stand surety for each other. The actual law was kind of built into the society as a set of guidelines, but the result of that was some, apparently at least some of the greatest Irishmen ever produced. So whilst it sounded quite restrictive, it did in fact give people the structure they needed to live full and happy lives, it sounds.
And that's what you need to do. As soon as you start collaborating with other people, is you need some structures, you need some rules, you need to know where you stand with each other. And the greatest mistake that people often make when they set up maybe communities or try to share assets like houses or farms, businesses, is when they do it with their friends, is they go in there making all sorts of assumptions about, oh, well, we understand each other and we can communicate and we know it's, we won't have a problem, because, you know, that's the wrong way to approach things. You should go into everything with rules in place. So you can operate in a quite a relaxed and free-form kind of way, but actually if at any point in time you have to stop and take an account of where we are, or we have to arbitrate, you know, how a decision might be made, is we actually know how to do that. And we got all of that experience by attending Radical Roots workshops, going to their quarterly gatherings for 3 years, because they ran them exactly using those processes.
And who are Radical Roots?
Radical Roots is a secondary co-op. It doesn't actually exist, but the members, of Radical Roots are themselves either housing co-ops or worker co-ops, or housing co-ops or worker co-ops that are trying to form. And they send a member to the meeting as a delegate. And the meeting is comprised of, so it's created by that collection of delegates. It's a secondary co-op. And
that's interesting. So it's a kind of expression on a larger scale of the kind of pixel level development.
It's generated by the relationship. So it only exists because it fulfills the function. And the function that it fulfills is facilitating people to start new co-ops, share resources, exchange ideas, and exchange learning.
And what are the basic things they put across then? You know, what's at the kind of, if you like, at the root of their structure, do you think?
Well, they've probably got three or four areas that they can offer. One is about financial advice, because as soon as you want to either own or manage an asset, it's going to involve numbers, you know, and that's a language. Just like words, it's a language, and not all of us are good at that. So we need to express numbers in the ways which, you know, bean counters and bank tellers can understand that, because we might need to finance projects. But actually, if you know how to write a spreadsheet and a business plan, is anybody can go and borrow money and set up a business, start a business. You don't need to have, you know, and if we're doing that for ethical, for mutual, for long-term mutual benefit reasons, then, you know, that's a good thing to do, right?
Absolutely. And I think that collection of people within those cooperatives, you know, like we're experiencing at the moment,
yes,
you know, the sum of the parts is so much greater, you know, really, than what we could all do alone.
What we could do alone, and the set of skills that's then embedded with that.
Exactly.
And every time we go through, have our quarterly meeting, and every time we return our accounts, and every time we resolve an issue at our co-op, is we gain experience. And with that experience, we can share that with other co-ops, as share that perspective in a mutual self-help way.
And so what comes after the... Because you're right, we do unfortunately have to be engaged with finance the way things are at the moment.
So the first one is you need to learn the language of finance and how to express that in a way in which it isn't too scary. And actually, what most people find is that's really empowering. Oh, wow, I didn't know I could do that. You know, hugely self-empowering. The next area is what we don't really know about is how to come together as groups and make decisions by consensus.
Yay.
Our culture isn't rich in those skills.
Our managers sit a sword's length apart because they can't trust each other.
Well, exactly, you know. Exactly. So there's a whole kind of skill set. And within the heart of that is how to come together and have effective meetings.
Mm. Which is about, fundamentally, it's about communication, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Always.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, effective meetings, which is how groups of people come together and communicate, and agree on priorities, and agree on strategies, and agree on, you know, make decisions. Break big tasks down into little tasks and go away and action those little tasks. And that's, if we can do that, we can achieve anything that we want. But most people, if you mention meeting, they're filled with dread and go, oh my God, not another bloody, you know. And if that's happening to us, alarm bell should be going off.
It comes back also to this holistic approach to our lives, you know, and us taking responsibility for the right thought, right word, right action, you know, and what we're saying, what we're feeling, what we're doing is the same thing, you know, and I think that's a really important part of it. And, you know, for that to be a big focus of you know, going into a situation where you're trying to collaborate with people, you know, on all levels.
How you do things and how you say them are really important, aren't they? Because there's many ways of putting across a message. You can kick off with a whole load of criticism and then chuck in a positive point, or you can kick off with a fair few positive points and then come up with but here's a thing that I think we could really do with addressing. And the whole way the meeting goes changes as a result of the way the people are handling it. How do they basically manage a meeting? Because they can be, when they're productive, they're really enjoyable. When they're really, really long and they produce nothing at all, it's just a waste of your time. You'd be better out making dandelion wine or something.
Common vision, isn't it? Yeah.
So, where the medical groups run their meetings. I was an active member for 5 years. They have 4 quarterly gatherings and they're planned a year in advance. So you know exactly, you know, what the deal is.
What's covered.
And what's coming. And I would suggest that each co-op should run itself according to a similar model. Is you just set your quarterly meetings, you know, a year in advance, 5 years in advance, chisel it in stone, you know, and you just have them. But the rules of the meeting is someone has to chair it and someone has to take the minutes. And the minutes are just record the decisions and the action points. And all the chair has to do is to make sure that everybody gets heard and that you stick to the agenda. And you must have an agenda. And ideally, like with Radical Roots, they suggest that you get the agenda a week before the meeting. And on the agenda, you don't say things like, we need to talk about the garden, because that's just an open-ended discussion. You need to make a proposal. And a proposal is something like, we need to buy a polytunnel to put in X marks the spot, and it's going to be 30 metres long and going to cost £999.
And this is what it's going to take to maintain it. This is
and
what we're
going to Andrea's do, going to be the project leader and Ollie's going to be leaning on the spade. And that's a proposal. And then at Radical Roots, you had 10 minutes to agree on a proposal, and there could be 55 different co-ops there. And if we didn't agree in 10 minutes, it was sent to a workshop, which was, we're not ready to say yes to that proposal yet, and that the people who object to it go away and work with the proposers to improve it. So then you're collectively working to create, build something that benefits everybody, and it, you could all then put into.
So it's, it's kind of like a dragon's den.
Yeah, so we were taught in a way in which
you said that.
It's not a negative thing. It's not, the name of our new co-op, of course.
Dragon's Dens are full of treasure, and you've got your Dragons Cooperative as well. So we like dragons.
And we've inherited the name. The shop was already called Dragons. Yeah. So we just thought, how can we go against that?
And we're Wales, of course.
Yes, that's too perfect. And I think that, obviously, Pistol Rider is the dragon's lair. There is a dragon up there somewhere. There we go. So, anyway, we digress.
How to run meetings and communicate effectively, which sounds like a method for actually getting the best thought out ideas to the top of the schedule, really, which is what you want, isn't it? You need to know.
Absolutely. And the ones that haven't been fully formed yet, you don't need 40, 50 people sat around, discussing minutiae. That should have been done outside of the meeting. Yeah. So they're very good at streamlining that process. And then I guess the rest of it is about skill sharing and networking, you know, because the big lesson over the 20 years of being involved in co-ops, 23 or 4 years now, is they thrive when they're networked. If you actively support each other, then they thrive. If you, in isolation, they can start to behave a bit like dysfunctional families and get stuck in behavioural loops and things like that, where you just kind of repeat the same things all the time. So there's an awful lot of learning.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point at this juncture as well, because we've now, largely as a result of the internet, but also because there's many of us still insisting on meeting kind of in meet space, as it were. But what we've got now is a whole load of really effective networks that are learning a whole load of really useful things. And it seems to me that networking the networks, which is what it sounds like this organisation have done, is absolutely critical to us making larger scale progress.
No, it's absolutely, and I think that, you know, the learning, it comes a lot, the early lessons, they take a long time to learn. So it took us 14, 15 years to set up the first co-op, make it really work, you know, before it started to, you know, mature and what have you. We set up three more since then, and, you know, we actually, now we're sort of getting to our stride. One of the things we would like to offer through Dragons, through Sector 39, through the permaculture teaching, is we really do want to share this knowledge. So we do it through the permaculture courses, but we want to maybe offer consultancies or work with groups to help them develop and form their own ideas.
Yeah, and the other members of the cooperative, you know, bringing those skills into the mix as well, you know, and there's such a, like I said, you know, a real massive sum of the parts really that are involved with this that could help on such a big level. And it's this global focus, you know, global, local kind of...
This sort of global awareness and then this local action.
Yeah.
And you know, I think the other thing that's really important, speaking more generally, is that one of the most important things that any of us can do right at this now, at this time, is to create working models, create examples of the things that we want to see happen.
And really be so that change.
Whether they're how successful or not they are doesn't matter, because we'll make loads of mistakes, but we'll learn a whole load. Mm-hmm. And I've now just gone now to have the confidence just to go after things and... you know, and if it feels right, if the energy is there, literally it will happen. This whole co-op idea, Dragons Co-op, was a brand new idea on the 1st of April this year, when we literally saw the for sale sign coming up outside this property, which is opposite where I already live. And we just said, yes, I can see an opportunity there. And then perhaps from having the experience of having done it before, but knowing that there's this amazing network of people surrounding us that are now increasingly interested in these things, the 400 odd people that we know who've done our permaculture design course, and thousands of others that we've met through talks and what have you.
And extended networks of people who are doing the same thing, you know, in many other places across the globe.
This is why we're excited by community radio, networking the networks, what you were just saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And bringing it out, you know, with the Roots Project stuff, with Craftenings, with your Sector 39, you know, with Annie Beekeeping, you know, there's a real, like, movement in so many ways, you know, to share knowledge, you know, and that is just incredible. And through Dragon Cooperative and having this space, you know, to be able to, you know, like Steve is saying, put that front there so people can link in, you know, to that on a physical level.
And we want to have a big online presence, but literally people could walk in through our door and
come for a cup of tea.
Yeah.
I really do think that the online thing has helped a lot if people have actually met each other.
It's sort of 10 times more powerful, isn't it? And if you just get together every two or three years, you can refresh that connection. And
you can have a really good time doing it as well. You know, because it's not just information, is it? It's nearly all the people I come across who are involved in these seriously alternative projects actually have entertainment skills as well. They might be stand-up comics or musicians or whatever, but
we all like to play and tell stories, and we like to cook. And obviously I think the other thing that we want to put the heart of, we do put the heart of our permaculture courses, our permaculture teachings, is food. And again, I guess that's the connection to the soil, but the food, that manifestation of that, and sharing food. And we don't put the cooks in a shed down the bottom of the road, you know, and have them serve us. Is we put them right in the middle of the course, and we involve everybody in that process, because that's
really great. We're hoping to, because I met your caterers when I was at the fire in the mountain. I'm seriously hoping to get them on the show to talk about it as well.
Just had a wonderful experience weekend at the Llanfyllin Workhouse, and they're having that's a wonderful community project, as the Llanfyllin community people came together and took ownership of this huge old building, 1836 old...
24,000 square feet.
Yeah, you know, poorhouse, workhouse. Yeah. It had been empty for 25 years, and no one really knew what to do with it. It's a legacy building. And slowly, slowly, but it's becoming a community hub, permaculture, creativity, music, art, celebration.
Mm-hmm. And how is that? How is that owned? Is it owned by the cooperative? Do they manage to buy it off somebody?
It's owned as a trust. It's a building preservation trust, which is a legal structure used to own historic buildings like castles and cathedrals. But it is essentially the Board of Trustees is our community. So essentially it is a cooperative community asset. Yeah.
And they're kind of working, now here's an interesting thought. Presumably having people like that in charge of such a building enables the kind of ethos and the ideas to start spreading their way into government, because you're inevitably going to have business with, I don't know, listed building consent, or there's just a million different ways that you're going to be interacting with, for want of a better word, authority, and presumably you can spread good practice a little wider.
Absolutely, but I mean, and more broadly, is we want to work with every sector and link in every way. So we do stuff with schools.
It's inclusion, it's total inclusion, isn't it?
And again, this is why we want to be on the high street.
Yeah,
for your local permaculture needs. You know, where we are.
I think actually being integrated with the local community is so crucial, because some of the places we've lived, they're really not popular with the local community, and it's really necessary to be working with as many people as possible, especially being as we're looking at sharing what are both new and very ancient ideas.
Indeed.
And collecting, you know, collaborating with communities, networking communities, as we were talking about before, but kind of doing that to form like a more intricate web, and trying to take a perspective on that to get to see what everyone's doing in their different areas, and kind of work collectively then, like, more like the beehive, so it's not just all these individual communities everywhere, but as the beehive forms, it's forming more of a super organism,
and that's hub of consciousness.
That's what we're working towards.
Those interconnections, those mutually beneficial relationships that interconnect us together. Yeah, we're not all trying to occupy the same space, but there's loads of crossing points and overlaps. Mm. And it's those things, I guess, a lot of what I teach in permaculture is, what I'm interested in is those things that we all have in common. Mm. You know, those are the bits we should focus on. The stuff that we disagree about, irrelevant, doesn't matter. But we've all have things in common around, whether it's water, food, soil, clean air, freedom to express ourselves.
Education, the ability
to communicate. To, you know, these are all things that we have absolutely in common with each other, and we should be celebrating that and sharing skills and knowledge about how to be effective in those areas. And all the other stuff just doesn't matter. That's the diversity, and let's celebrate it. You know, you like pink, I like blue, or whatever, you like Man United, and I like whatever, you know, none of that matters. It's that diversity is part of the fun of it.
The diversity, and I think this...
It's interesting. Not everyone can be the goalkeeper. If we all support one team, it's boring, isn't it?
Yeah.
But when it comes to making key decisions, we need to focus on those things that we're all agreed on.
I love that idea that I can't remember. I think it was in China where people don't necessarily cheer when their own team scores a goal. They cheer when anybody scores a goal, because it's basically good for the whole.
Yeah.
I suppose to...
Brilliant. I love that.
I remember going to the ice hockey in Canada, and there they don't cheer when their team scores, but if your team concedes, you boo. So it's just a totally negative experience. Like,
yeah. That's the one. It's definitely up to us to share in progress rather than look at the differences between ourselves. And it does sound like you're being remarkably successful at that. I look forward to talking more about that in the future, because there's clearly, you know, all the way from Zimbabwe through the workhouse to the Dragon Co-op, there seems to be such an invaluable wealth of...
And then connecting that with South America as well, you know, like the elders that we're bringing over, it's also going to function as like part of it's going to, you know, we can talk about the cultures, communities that we're working with in the Amazon and the Andes.
And we went to Uganda as well, we're going to be serving coffee from Mount Elgon, which is a cooperative run by women set up 20 years ago for a reforestation. You know, it's
Hey man, I'm really so pleased to know you guys. That sounds absolutely great. Although I don't travel a lot, I seldom leave the UK. I do have a great love of the Maya and the Inca, and I'm thoroughly fascinated, because I realise that these guys myths, their stories are actually probably more reliable than our science. We've forgotten things. We've forgot somebody told us that the Earth revolved around the sun like 200 years before the Common Era or whatever, and Galileo's still getting into trouble for it for 1700 years later. But these ancient peoples, they're remembering things. You know,
I think also the communities that, I mean, that Ollie and Steph have spent time in, I spent time, Steve spent time in as well, and I'm sure many other people have. You know, you see this just a resilience in a community, you know, and you see just a lot more of a rich structure that does support, you know, all generations, you know, within that community as well. And there's just such, you know, diversity within that.
It's instinctive for people.
Yeah, it is. And I think they're a lot closer to our natural being, you know.
There's a lot we can learn from them.
You know, as human beings, I think we are kind of programmable, really. That's our nature, isn't it? You know, and it's really interesting when you look at, like, these different cultures, different situations, wherever it is across the world, you know, whatever dimension you're talking about. You know, it's a very, it's an amazing thing to observe. It really is,
And when you live in cooperation with other people rather than in competition, you have to put in, I mean, you're still putting in a lot of effort, but you get so much more from it. I mean, I think about how much it costs people to run their own telephone, their own internet, their own washing line, their own bathroom, their own water supply, all of that stuff. And that's just the cost end of things. It's not to do with how often you have to cook or how often you have to do the washing up. There's all manner of freedoms that come from the certain degree of restriction, maybe, that arises from living in community. And those freedoms can't be imagined until you actually try them. But you do have to be able to communicate and get on with other people.
That's right. And which is, you know, that's the area, unfortunately, that we're all weakest on. You know, we're culturally weakest on here, and our experience, how we've been brought up and trained, we're not rich in that. So therefore, that's the bit we need to focus on.
Which is why one of the reasons why I wanted to go into Crafty Newtons is the reason why that feels like such an important thing to do. And we've been running this for like a year and a half over here, but you know, it started over in Guatemala, and just bringing people together, you know, in a space where it's like a right brain space,
the most,
people are open.
The most,
so do we get to learn some Guatemalan skills at Crafty Newtons?
I did. Well, I learned many skills in Guatemala, I've got to say. Yeah, for another time, really.
But it's really about creating that space.
Yeah, it
and
is.
And the most human of things to do, and for our whole 100,000 years of Homo sapiens, is we sat around in circles and we plaited bits of straw together to make little baskets and little, you know, fabrics and things. And we chit-chatted about the babies and the community and what crops we're going to plant and, you know,
all that community, the cohesive structure, ceremonies, celebrations, for ritual, for, you know, exchange, for, you know, so many things. It's using
and into
our
those
hands, we actually,
our stories and our history and our cultural ideas are woven into those very fabrics. Mm-hmm. And you say, heritage. Worn for rituals and worn for communications and worn for, you know,
and for
social cohesion.
Absolutely.
And so your Craft and Noons thing, it sounds almost trivial, we're making some, is that's the, it's actually, no, it's at the very heart of what I said before about what makes communities when we create things together, and then we have a sense of collective ownership. And this is what we've lost. We've lost in our society and culture. What we really have to reconnect with is we've been disconnected from the natural world, disconnected from the vibration, the animism of what you talked about, Ollie. We've been trying to fit nature into a box, like what you've been talking about with the bees and what the permaculture, what the crafts, what we're all talking about here is about creating pathways, creating opportunities for people to reconnect with what's real and tangible
themselves, and through
co-ops. And the cooperatives is, I'm very keen to say to people is, you know, there are other ways to own and manage assets like houses, like farms, like buildings that we can, you know, do these kinds of activities in and recreate communities. There's a lot of opportunities now, and there's a collective awareness, which is, I know what you're talking about, Dr. Rock, is, you know, with our communications, our internet and everything, is suddenly there's this collective learning that's going to create, hopefully, a you know, everybody needs to stop, not just to move from talking about this stuff to doing it, making it manifest in whatever way that we can.
And people are all creative, aren't they? I mean, as I've said before here, what we've got at the moment is a one-size-fits-nobody society.
Yes.
And giving people a bit of... So I would imagine, Andrea, that some people are a little bit reluctant to explore their creativity. Do you see that happening? And
I think the main thing that... I don't really draw, or I don't really do this, you know, and then it's really interesting to see that process people go through, you know, when you show simple crafts that actually create something that is quite something, you know, and just the joy actually that people experience at the end of that process, you know, looking at something, whether it's a paper basket that they've woven or a dream capture that they've made or a macrame necklace that they've done or a feather earring or a leather pouch or, you know, whatever it is, a mask, you know, we do kids crafting as well. And
it's a really,
you know, it's
process.
A really interesting thing, you know, and it's led me to get to a point where I've started to realize that there's an element of this that can really help with personal development actually, you know, and we do a lot of work, you know, on a spirit level, on a mental level, you know, emotional level, whatever. And, you know, to actually embody that into the physical is a really, really important part of that process that doesn't often happen, actually.
And
on a conscious level, anyway. You know,
Do you see new things springing to life as a result of this realization in people when they're sort of led, as it were, towards investigating their own creativity? Do you see them come alive and run with the project ever?
I feel very humbled to watch some of these people like that have come to Craftanoons over the last year and a half and actually just linked into something that they didn't even know that was there and go away and continue that, you know. And I'm speaking actually from experience here because this happened to me and it's really quite interesting.
You were one of those people.
I was one of those people, you know.
Me
and
too.
I've shown a skill in Peru through a very dear sister, and she ignited something in me that just totally just blew me away. And it was, I was just encouraged to share it and by her, and I did, and it's turned into Craftanoons, you know. And it's really interesting watching that process in myself, really. And like I said, you know, showing people these different skills or just giving them actually the space, as Steve was saying, for them to really be inspired and use their imagination, you know. And there's someone mentioned to me that the gateway between the spiritual and the physical is the imagination. And, you know, that is totally unlimited. And you're really only limited by your imagination. So, you know, someone in space and you give them materials and you give them glue and wool. And, well, I mean, we
and
just
a basic
use,
skill.
We just use, yeah, I mean,
it?
It's like the weaving, you know, it's very basic weaving, the techniques that we teach, but... You know, to be able to wrap a stone or a crystal or a whatever, you know, trinket or amazing piece of nature that you've picked up on your adventures, you know, to weave it into something that is, you know, it can hang on your person, you know, and we're all talking about energetics and lots of different levels in that sense, you know, and these things, the intention, as I said, is everything as far as I'm concerned.
I like it when you do bring that beautiful piece of nature and wear it on your person. It's almost like you've brought an essence of that beauty into your being, together with your own raw creativity.
Yeah, you're definitely wearing its energy and you're wearing its geometry. Because
exactly.
I mean, the same thing happened to me, and again, it was because of the ceremonies. I got introduced to geometry, and along with the Mayan calendars that I was painting, I started painting geometry and glow-in-the-dark paints on stones. And I'd been put off artwork at junior school by a guy who gave me a real stripping down, and I didn't believe I could do any of this stuff. And I find it one of the most freeing things I can do, especially when combined with people's internet radio, because I can listen to the radio whilst painting beautiful things.
There's so many ways to work with that as well. And you are, I mean, you know, when you're using natural crafts and that kind of thing, you can really work with the elements, which is where I feel like is going to be the most potent transformations happen.
Yeah,
you know,
we'll be
with
We'll be doing an opening ceremony, hopefully, which will be calling in the energies of the directions and so the elements.
Indeed. Well, we're going to be running for afternoon, so we can embody that beautiful energy that you create.
Tell me, do you find that you're getting the opportunity to learn old skills from oldsters and teach them to youngsters? Do you find that there's a bit of a generational melding happens
in
these?
Myself and Stephanie went to the Spring Beekeeping Convention and we met some incredible women who were lace makers, and I've never really seen lace being made, I've got to say. I've known, obviously, there's been lace.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place in Nottingham that's like a lace mill or something. But, you know, I never really looked into, you know, our indigenous, you know, weavers, you know, and there's a lot of...
Such an intricate process. Yeah. It takes such a long time and so much patience. But traditionally, women would get together in circles and groups. And not the fabric and make lace.
Absolutely.
Similar to how they do in the Andes today, you know, it's kind of our interpretation of that.
Absolutely, and it was incredible to meet them. And
absolutely.
There was a couple of ladies in the 80s, you know, there was a couple of other ladies there a little bit younger, and just, you know, to have those conversations, and we only had a short amount of time with them, really, but to link into that, oh my God, it's just amazing. And you just meet so many people because a lot of our, well, the majority of our materials are all reclaimed and secondhand and gifted and recycled and upcycled, whatever, you know? So we spend time in charity shops and car boot sales and all sorts of different places, you know?
Isn't that fabulous though? Because that is genuine recycling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, rather than just sending it all over to Belgium so it can be shipped to India and sorted by people on the beach or whatever. Well, look, we've slipped past the witching hour.
Aha.
And that time really shot by for me. I'm now even more excited to be coming to the Conscious Tribal Gathering because I know that we're all going to be meeting up again, which is going to be really cracking. It'd be great if you could, if you'd consider joining me on I'm going to try and do a live show next Thursday night from the Conscious Tribal Gathering. And then perhaps we can get into that thing you were talking about earlier, which is this idea of using permacultural principles to transform Britain.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't wait to start on that one.
Redesigning Britain according to the principles and ethics of permaculture, and then compiling a network throughout the country,
mm-hmm.
and coming up with viable solutions. It'll be good on a much larger level. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like we already have the. Sounds like we already have the kind of basic bits of the infrastructure we need to start doing this.
It's already in motion. We just want to think about how we can accelerate that and amplify that without losing the local, small-scale, slow and steady nature of permaculture. So it's an interesting paradox. How to speed up something that in itself is naturally slow and small-scale.
Well, I think... it is so much, really, when push comes to shove, the influence that we have is at our own level with our own people and our own skills and our own receptiveness and consciousness and how we deal with the world. But we know, don't we, that when you get a group of people together with a shared intent, a dozen or so, even two instead of just one, it's so much magnifies the approach, yeah.
That's why I think we're excited about our new co-op and just having we're excited just to be sat around the table, the four of us now, because we're having a conversation that we wouldn't have had if we weren't in the same space as each other. So that in itself has been, you know, so we're grateful to you for facilitating that for us. So,
well, you've just been really great guests, and you're all welcome back on either all together or individually so we can explore a bit more about what's going on. And, I really am up on this show for networking the networks. We want to put people in touch with other people because that's where the solution's going to lie. It's going to lie in our intent and where we're putting our consciousness, where we're putting our meaningless promissory tokens, and just exactly how we use the spaces that we can now evidently acquire. And it's been really great you know, been really great having you on the show. It's been a very easy show for me, and I've like you say, I really look forward to listening to the podcast and hearing what you've all had to say.
Yes.
I raise my hat to the lot of you. Absolutely inspiring, I thought, and I think the chat box is pretty much of the same view as far as I can tell. So thank you very much to all of you. Thanks to Steph and to Ollie and to Andrea and to Steve for taking part in tonight's show. It's been a real joy, and I'm now going to play Horace X, Keeping the Upper Lip Stiff.